Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Back surgery, weight loss surgery, cardiac care. Incredibly complex medicine made easy to understand. Thanks to the DMC. Join Emery King at DMC.org to see why, when it's serious, go to Detroit. Check out the DMC videos today at DMC.org.
For our Olympic team, let them know you're out there. America'sCheer.com. If you cheer, they'll hear. This is America. Don't you belong at Bank of America? Bank of Opportunity.
Member FDIC.
The hottest technology in the world isn't being developed in Silicon Valley. In the United States Navy, more top-secret technologies are being created than ever before. Incredible machines made of stealth materials that fly by themselves. The only problem with these incredible technologies? It's a shame the enemy can't see them. To learn more, call 1-800-USA-NAVY or visit Navy.com. Navy. Accelerate your life.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Joining me, Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hello, Peter.
And happy Mother's Day to everyone who it is appropriate to wish.
Yes.
Yeah.
Then yes. Most definitely. I'm a mother of two dogs.
But that makes you, don't you?
Oh, no. We're starting out this way, are we really?
Well,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll take it.
All right.
I'll take it.
Happy Mother's Day.
Right. It's also the 100th anniversary of Mother's Day.
Yeah. At least.
Yeah. So
as an official holiday. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. I was at my friend's house celebrating with her family, and so I decided I have to do a little history, of course, you know.
Sure.
So it was 100 years ago, and it was a woman who didn't have any children, actually. Her mother wanted to be honored. She said, mothers should have a day. So this Anna Jarvis created it. And she said that all that really mothers should get is a white carnation, which is a sign of purity of a mother's love. Well, apparently she would be really appalled by what Mother's Day has become, because it's become one of these so-called Hallmark holidays. In a sense, it's a big day. It's huge amounts of money spent on mothers. I know I did. And apparently, this is so great, Peter. Before Anna Jarvis, the creator of Mother's Day, died in 1948.
So this is 40 years after she launched.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
She protested at a Mother's Day celebration in New York and was arrested for disturbing the peace.
Now, I don't understand, though, because Mother's Day goes way back. Julia Ward Howe, who wrote the words to the Battle Hymn of the Republic, you know, whatever. Famous words. Neither of us can remember. But anyway, in 1870, Julia Ward Howe, who was a big supporter of the Civil War of the Northern side, and the call to free the slaves, that she called for all women to rise up and oppose war in all forms. She was so horrified by the battle deaths and all the people wounded so badly. Actually, my great 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 something like that grandfather fought in the Civil War and was wounded twice in different battles, which is very unusual because you got wounded, man, you're gone.
Yeah,
you know all the infection.
Yeah.
Everything like that. And actually, he then wound up as a guard at sort of an infamous prisoner of war camp for Southern soldiers. And one of the inmates there carved a walking stick for him because he was having trouble walking. And it's still in our family.
Really?
We still have that.
How interesting.
Yeah. And so the Civil War was this makes sense. So the Civil War ended in 1865, and in about, there's a photograph of him in like 1915. So that's what, I can't do the math, 50 years later, he's still in his Civil War uniform. But, you know, he could have been in his 20s, so he's probably in his 70s.
Yeah,
Old Grandpa Werby. Actually, it wasn't Grandpa Werby. It was Grandpa Bigham. Bigham, yeah, Bigam. Not usually, it's Bigham,
Bingham.
Bingham, yeah, but this is Bigham.
Okay.
Wait a minute. I don't even know how to spell his name. What the hell? But Julia Ward Howe, back to her in 1870, called for women to rise up and oppose war in all its forms. And she called upon women to come together for this international conference across national lines to recognize, as she said, what we hold in common above what divides us and commit to finding peaceful resolutions to conflicts. Well, and she has
Was that the first to, women's conference?
Before we open up, are we on the air?
Hey, why prepare?
Yeah. All right.
It's free flow here.
Here's the basics. This is Night Call. I'm Peter Werby. Jalene Jordan is with me. And our telephone numbers are 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
For the bashful, and when the phones are filled, you can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. You know, we have not talked about the election almost at all, and no one hardly has brought it up, which to me is way okay.
Well, and it's a bit indicative of how tired of this that everyone is getting. I mean, already, how many? 30 debates already?
Is that what it's been?
Something like that, yeah.
Well, remember, way back in the abortive Michigan primary, it sounded from our show like the contest was between Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich.
Right.
No one ever mentioned those other people. It shows you where our folks are.
Right, yeah.
And I said a couple of times that I thought that the best and most proper, if you will, the most proper presidential contest should have been between Ron Paul on the right and Dennis Kucinich on the left. They certainly agree on a number of things about civil liberties, about the murderous war in Iraq, and a number of other things. And then they separate on, you know, like Kucinich wants a national health program, and Ron Paul, being the libertarian, so-called, mm-hmm. Doesn't want that. But now, it's gotten so weird. And I guess Obama is going to be the presidential candidate. He's already acting like it. He's talking about debates with McCain. Actually, my favorite talk show host, Stephanie Miller, refers to McCain as, was it Grumpy Grandpa McSame?
That's a good one.
Because it is more of the same. I mean, that's what he would be.
Well, I've noticed this, too, because when I'm on the air and on another air shift that I do, I was watching, you know, the CNN, which I only do when I'm kind of in the studio, usually. And it was all about Obama versus McCain. And this was earlier today, and I thought, wait, where's Hillary? Where the hell's Hillary?
Bye.
Yeah.
Bye, baby.
Right.
Don't let the door hit you in the butt.
Oh, no.
Come back in 2012, which could be her strategy. 2012. Wow. I'm going to do an interview later this week with Daniel Pinchbeck, who has written a book called 2012, The Return of, what is it, Quetzalcoatl? I think so. The Aztec God. 2012, I mean, that's like the end of the grand cycle, and everything's going to, I don't know.
Is this like Y2K all over again?
Yeah, this is like intergalactic Y2K.
Okay, have we started stocking up on water and canned goods yet?
Yeah.
Batteries?
Yeah. I saw a guy with a baseball cap that said Y2K on everything.
Really?
But I like to have that.
It was so yesterday.
Cindy McCain says she'll never make her tax returns public, even if her husband wins the White House and she becomes the first lady.
She's loaded.
Yeah, she's about $100 million. You know, how do they, already they've started trying to make Obama the elitist. What does that mean? He's not in touch with the common person. But McCain is. He's married to this multimillionaire. They got like 8 homes.
Yeah, and they made all their money from beer.
Beer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or she did. They have 8 homes?
Yeah. Yeah.
Who needs 8 homes?
Well, what's his name? How soon do we forget? Donald Rumsfeld.
Yeah.
That
old Rummy?
Old Rummy, who should be indicted as a war criminal.
For sure.
Yeah. But how soon do we forget? He has something like, I'm going to be conservative, 4 homes in New Mexico.
In New Mexico alone?
Yeah. Yeah.
And who needs that, once again?
Yeah. Well, he's got more money than he knows what to do with.
Excess is best for them, I guess.
McCain made $405,000 in 2007, but he's routinely ranked among the richest lawmakers in Congress, but they must be talking about his wife as well. They've kept their finances uncommingled.
Uncommingled, okay.
Actually, I'm not reading. I made that one.
That was pretty good.
They got a prenup. They got a prenup that that says she keeps her money.
Yeah. Have you seen their daughter?
No.
She looks like she's... I just saw a picture the other day, and I was in shock. She looks like she was fresh out of the pages of, like, Playboy magazine.
What do you mean? Was she naked?
No, she's just one of these blonde bombshell babes.
Oh.
You know, looks real manufactured.
I mean, sort of like a Fox newscaster.
Yeah, right.
Playboy, that's so 20th century.
Well, hey, Hugh's still hot. Come on.
Playboy just suffered a loss.
What?
Financial loss.
Oh, they did?
Not Hugh.
No, he's still around with his Viagra. He's fine.
Oh, God, I mean, it is. Never mind.
And his girlfriends.
And his girlfriends, yeah. Now, all this stuff going on in Myanmar, right? They think that I can't even face what the implications of this. They're thinking now there could be as many as 1 million people dying as a result of that cyclone. And then the fact that there's no aid getting to these people.
Yeah, I was just having this light conversation over Mother's Day dinner. And, you know, the question is, why would they not let the relief come in? And the answer by one of the members of the family was that basically they don't want anyone to come into their dictatorship and mess things up where it's completely messed up.
Grumpy Grandpa McCain, along with Senator Mitch McConnell in the Wall Street Journal in 2005, wrote this, and this is good. The junta in Myanmar routinely jails democracy activists, sometimes resorting to torture and murder. The Burmese, which Myanmar used to be called, Burma, military employs rape as a weapon of war, destroying the lives of innocent ethnic minority women and girls. Child soldiers are pressed into the military's rank and file. Narcotics production remains a profitable business, with illegal drugs flowing across Burma's border into neighboring countries. Close quote. So let's give a big hand. Well, wait a minute.
No. Nah.
Okay. Because here's what happened. The public relations executive, whom, what should we call him that all the time? Grumpy Grandpa McCain campaign has chosen to run the Republican National Committee this summer, resigned his post yesterday after a magazine reported that his firm had lobbied for the military junta that runs Myanmar.
Yeah, so this awful dictator is loved by this guy.
Yeah.
And why?
Doug Goodyear said in a statement he was stepping down as a coordinator of the convention, which will be held September 1st to 4th in Minneapolis, so as not to become a distraction in this campaign. In other words, he would have kept doing it if they hadn't been exposed by Newsweek.
His firm was paid $350,000 to represent the junta.
To burnish the junta's image, which means to kind of spark it up. This is John McSame's guy that was going to run the party. They've killed thousands. Yeah,
nice guy.
Nice guys. He somehow or other, though, that McSame, I don't know. Well, I mean, he has like made some good noises once in a while. And so the conservatives don't like him because they don't think he's a whack job right winger like they are.
Yeah, he's not nutty enough.
He's not nutty enough for him.
He's way, way too nuts for him.
And in the different primaries recently, 25% of Republican voters did not vote for him in the election, in the primary there. Mm-hmm. So the Washington Times, a conservative newspaper, calculated that McCain has garnered no more than 45% of the Republican vote since January.
You know, people will fall in line, though, Peter.
They probably will.
They will.
But now he's promising to nominate conservative justices to any possible new Supreme Court vacancies. Why does this say page 2 and there's nothing on it? I don't know. GOP, that's the Great Oil Party. Although grand old parties, known the Republican Party, crushed in polls. John McCain is planning to run as a different kind of Republican, but according to Politico.com, being any kind of Republican seems like some sort of death sentence these days. The anti-Republican mood is fairly big, and it seems overwhelming, said Michigan Republican Party Chairman Saul Anuzis, I guess his name is. Let's see. Things are so bad that many people don't even want to call themselves Republicans. The Pew Research Center for People in the Press has found the lowest percentage of self-described Republicans in 16 years of polling. They've lost, like in these deep South districts that previously had been Republican for the longest time. So if they're losing those people. Let's see here. Oh, yeah. And there's this big debate as to whether McCain even voted. Of course, this would be a plus for him, right? Whether he even voted for Bush in 2000. Did you see that?
Oh, I did see that.
Yeah. That Arianna Huffington, who runs Huffington Post, said that he said at a Los Angeles dinner party shortly after the 2000 election that he had not voted for the president he was now publicly embracing in his own quest for the White House. Why would McSame embrace Bush?
Yeah, that's why would anybody?
Yeah, it's like a guy who, you know, it's like Bush has immolated himself in the whole Republican Party, and he's on fire, and McSame gives him a big, big hug.
Yeah. And then one of his aides, did you see what he said about Arianna? She's a flake and a poser and an attention-seeking diva. Okay, how about, you know, to me, that's insulting as a woman. Do you know what I'm saying?
Go ahead. What do you mean?
Well, you know, you have to put in the attention-seeking diva. It can't just be a woman who actually has information.
Oh,
let's not go. Gotcha. Let's not go crazy. Yeah. Give the woman some credit or anything.
You know, one of the reasons that the Republicans have fallen as far as they have, and rightly so, is that they've been shown to be such hypocrites. I mean, if you think about the Democrats' fortune, really went down the drain in a lot of ways because of people's racism, because of people's fears. I mean, really, stuff that was put on them, I think, unfairly by these right-wingers. And unfortunately, people were dumb enough to buy it. Now they're finally figuring it out. But think about the hypocrisy of these, particularly mostly men in the Republican Party, who have been exposed in so many different things. Well, you can't even remember them all. All those guys, they've gone to jail because they were all tied in with that lobbyist. Sometimes the brain works.
Yeah. Which one?
Yeah, which one?
Which bad lobbyist?
Which guy got caught doing what sexual thing with what, page?
Remember the ball gag?
The ball gag. Oh, but this is probably...
We had a good time with that one.
I support ball gags for Republicans. Grumpy Grandpa McSame voted with Bush Co. 95% of the time. So he's a Bush clone.
Yes, he is.
So you vote for McSame, you get the same. But even some of these guys, Vito J. Fuseli, who is a congressman from Staten Island, the only Republican coming out of New York City. And it turns out he's served 5 terms in Congress, and he was stopped, arrested, and charged after running a red light in Alexandria, Virginia, and he was drunk on his butt. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that happens.
It happens.
But, you're supposed to be this model citizen, right? And he wasn't.
Yeah.
So then it turns out, though, within days of his admitting that he was on his way to visit, quote, some friends in Virginia, when he was stopped by the police, the New York tabloids began raising questions about the woman who came to retrieve him from custody. He's married and got 3 kids, who turned out to be a former Air Force lieutenant colonel named Laura Fay. Doesn't the other woman always named Laura Fay?
I don't know.
I think so. So he released a statement, finally, the congressman did, saying he had fathered a daughter, now 3 years old, in an extramarital affair with Laura Fay. And the deal is, like, if that happened to me, you know, if I'm married, and then if I had a child with a
another
lover,
family?
Yeah, I'd say, hey, so what? It's none of your business. But I'm not around posing as this moral beacon, pro-family.
Right.
Because that's what sends everybody over the edge, that these guys are such incredible hypocrites. Let's see. After he got in, he established himself as a reliable member of his party. He voted to impeach Clinton because, of course.
Right.
He followed President Bush's war policies in Iraq, voted to eliminate funding for Planned Parenthood.
Mm-hmm.
He needed that.
Yeah.
Big time. Yeah, he would be in the
dummy.
And supported a constitutional amendment against gay marriage.
Yeah, and I liked this part. It was from the New York Times. As Jerry Seinfeld observed at the time, back when the Clinton White House scandal was going on, everybody lies about sex. In fact, Mr. Seinfeld said, people lie during sex. If it weren't for lies, there'd be no sex.
Oh, my God. Now,
it's not having a whole lot of faith in the Institute of Marriage.
No.
But
now, Grumpy Grandpa McSame voted with Bush Co. 95% of the time. This right-winger only voted with Bush 88% of the time.
Ah.
So Mr. Independent, John McSame, has a worse voting record in terms of backing the most unpopular president in modern history than this self-admitted right-winger.
Yeah, so you want more of the same, you say?
Yeah. Now, also, another one of these hypocrites and phonies, Senator David Vitter of Louisiana. Remember, he's the one that got caught. He got outed by Larry Flint from Hustler magazine.
Oh, yeah.
That he was a customer. Did he have the ball gag on? Was that him?
He may have been the ball gag guy.
Yeah, with the D.C. madam. And the ethics Senate Ethics Committee on Thursday dismissed the complaint against him. It was brought by Crew. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington.
Oh, boy. There is such a thing?
Yeah, right. So he's gotten off scot-free, and Deborah Jean Palfrey, the D.C. madam, committed suicide.
She did. I read that recently. I was just going to ask if you knew that.
So here is the woman who was providing prostitutes for the mm-hmm. high and mighty.
Yeah.
All these paragons and pinnacle of morality and pro-family, like Republican Senator David Vitter of Louisiana. And who goes to jail and who, with the shame and the horror facing the horror of imprisonment, commits suicide.
I know. There's just everything is wrong with that.
Crew, which is this ethics group. So the dismissal of the complaint was in line with the committee's, quote, standard operating procedure. While Deborah Jean Palfrey, who committed suicide last week, was found guilty of operating a prostitution ring, Senator Vitter has not been held accountable for his activities. He walks away without even a slap on the wrist.
Well, you know, seems to be the pattern, so to speak.
Yeah. Here's a pattern. This is Night Call. We've been doing this for a couple of years here on WRIF. 313-298-WRIF. And any comments, please feel free. Or, as always, we're open line. Oh, let me read an email, too. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Short messages, please, if you want me to even consider reading them on the air. I just can't edit them quickly. This is from Kim in Dearborn Heights. She writes, just an invitation to all your listeners to join the Iraq Moratorium. Now, the Iraq Moratorium is on the third Friday of every month, and this is like the 8th, maybe the 9th, but this is happening once a month. It happens all over the country. And they're pretty localized. People can take these up as activity in their community. And I would urge people to do that. Go to iraqmoratorium.org. Moratorium is MORATORIUM. Moratorium, like a cessation. That's really a Vietnam era word. I was thinking, I wonder if that's even common usage for, say, people under 30. Moratorium?
I wouldn't think so.
Sounds like someplace where they bury people.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I'm going to the moratorium.
Yes.
Yeah, but no, you can go to the moratorium and sing for peace, stand for an end to war. It's a gathering this Friday, May 16th. We will meet in front of St. John's Episcopal Church on the corner of 11 Mile and Woodward. That's in Royal Oak at 5:30 p.m. for half an hour of rousing singing led by Julie Butel, who's a wonderful singer, followed by a vigil on the corner from 6 to 7. We encourage folks to bring percussion instruments, plastic eggs filled with rice.
Oh, to make noisemakers.
Yeah, but where do you get plastic eggs?
Oh, I have some.
What do you do with them?
Well, if you have kids, you have Easter egg hunts. If you're a Christian and you have kids, you usually have an...
You're neither.
That I know. Well, yeah, I can't really explain it.
Okay.
I have pack rat.
Okay. I mean, aren't those things that kind of like come apart?
Yeah.
And what do you put inside of them? Rice!
Rice,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, never mind.
Yeah.
Kitchen pots and wooden spoons and upside-down garbage cans work great.
Oh, yeah. They want to make some noise.
They want to make some noise. Yeah, pots and pans all over, particularly Latin America. That's what people protesting do. They come out, the women do, come out with pots and pans and bang on them. Also, please remind listeners that Mother's Day originated as a call to end war. Mothers of the world unite, moms not bombs. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you for writing in. All right. Whoa. We got a lot of people waiting to talk here. Yeah, we got time to take some calls before our first break. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Our first caller is Rick from Woodhaven. Rick, hi. It's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm good.
I've listened to you sporadically through the years, every now and then.
Good.
And I just was listening to you talk about Republicans. I'm not a Republican or a Democrat.
Me neither.
But you just act like there's a difference between Republicans and Democrats. There's not really a difference They're all the same.
Well, you know, that's what I'm afraid of. I'm going to get, I'm going to wind up, you know, like defending Barack Obama. Whereas I think that in terms of my beliefs, the problems that really have to be addressed in this country aren't going to be taken up by him. There'll be some changes, but I'll tell you, normally I would have said, and for years and years I said the same thing. It was Tweedledee and Tweedledummer, although I think the Republicans always made it for the latter. But now that what's essentially happened is the Republican Party had moved away from the centrist and corporatist ruling agreement and began to, and the Republican Party moved so far to the right that there actually is a difference. I'll let you talk in a second, but let me just say, the New Deal reforms, which never went far enough in this country to give the people of the United States what they deserved, and you know, programs that and policies that are in evidence in every other industrial country in the world, were at least something of a thin safety net, a thin reed for lots of people, Social Security, some Medicare, and what have you. This group of Republicans have done so much damage to the protections of that we had established for the environment, for workers' rights, women's rights, and what have you. And again, I don't want to sell Clinton. I don't want to sell the Democratic Party, but they were better than a stick in the eye, as the English say, and Bush Co., this racket for the rich masquerading as a government, is far worse than any Democratic administration, I would say. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, when Bill Clinton was in office, he started NAFTA and
right.
pushed NAFTA through. And what has that done for the middle class of this country?
Hurt us.
Zero.
Hurt us. No, not
okay.
zero. Hurt us.
Right.
Less than
yeah.
zero. Yeah. Listen,
okay.
He's done a lot of things. He was not, contrary to Al Gore saying they were going to be the environmental presidency, they weren't good on the environment. That sure, both historically, both parties have sold out to corporate interests. But it doesn't mean, for instance, that they're the same. When let's start with A, arsenic. Well, how much arsenic is allowable in the water? To support mining interests, Bush unilaterally signed an executive order allowing more in those states where this is an issue and where there's mining, has allowed more arsenic in the water. Mining safety, put in mining lobbyists to govern an industry, and on and on and on like that. The Democrats are nothing to write home about, but the Republicans, for every crime that the Democrats have committed, in the last 8 years, you can name 40 that the Republicans have done.
Well, yeah, you're probably right. But I've just come to the point where I just refuse to vote anymore because you're voting for the rich. They're all for the rich. They're for no one else.
You know, I've heard a lot of people saying that lately. A lot of
right.
people have just kind of lost hope completely, which is...
Well,
well, you
yeah.
know, Rick, you're not unusual. Even
right.
in these big contested elections... We always say nobody won. Like in the last election in 2004, stolen for the second time in a row by Bush, the official returns were that Bush got, 28% and Kerry got, 26% uh-huh. of the possible electorate. And about 44% took your route, didn't vote.
Yeah, I just think it's a real shame. I mean, I don't know where the answer is, and I actually think that people actually have to band together, and something's got to be done. That's the only way something will get done, but people can't stick together these days.
Well,
it
is hard. Here's why I'm going to vote, is that I think Obama is easily going to be the lesser of the two evils. Look, you got a guy in there that says okay to have troops in Iraq for 100 years, and I don't know what Obama's going to do. I mean, I say to some people, and they say, "Oh, it's going to be a change." I say, "You're going to feel real bad when President Obama invades Venezuela," and they say, "Oh, he'll never do that." Well, maybe he won't, probably won't. But what I'm going to do on November, whatever it is, 2nd or 9th, or I can't remember the date of the election, hopefully it will be, I'll have done two or three other political things, because voting is pretty passive. I mean, the results of it turn out to be very important. But Barack Obama will definitely be the lesser of two evils. And I got to tell you, over the last 7-8 years, I have directly experienced little harm. Sure, because of, you know, Bush has sold out the country and driven it into debt. I, along with you and everyone else, owe a lot of money to the Saudis and to the Chinese and the Japanese and the English banks and what have you, because we're now a debtor nation. Our money's worth less because of his economic policies and his giveaway to the wealthy. But, you know, I haven't been driven into debt. I didn't get a subprime mortgage. I haven't lost any kids in Iraq. I didn't have any of my children come home maimed or with one of the 300,000 with brain injuries or something like that. Nothing happened directly to me. So, you know, you could almost say, yeah, you know, what's the difference? What the hell? I might as well stay home. But the farther you are away from the centers of power and privilege, and if we're middle class, we're pretty close to the center. I know we're not in the, you know, in the top 1% or 5% or 10%, or at least I'm not. But when you start thinking about, for instance, Bush's and McSame says he's going to similarly appoint justices, which would mean very possible a woman's right to choose abortion could be wiped out. Already they found against workers, the Supreme Court has, that in job discrimination in, cases, and, you know, involving gender and what have you. So to me, getting in the lesser of the two evils, as opposed to the evil of the two lessers. And actually, well, I don't know. Go ahead. Give me a final thought, and I'm going to go on.
Well, here's a good thought, Peter. Maybe they should just leave it up to the superdelegates. The average people don't mean nothing. If you're a superdelegate, they say you can swing it one way or another. What makes them more important than the average person? What a joke. What a system we have.
Well, maybe we ought to go back to the way, you know, these right-wing conservatives are always talking about strict construction of the Constitution. Let's let it go back to white property men.
Oh, my God.
Be the voters.
You're killing me.
All right. Thank you very much.
Phew.
I appreciate it, Rick. Did you say that that is the... you hear that from people, huh? I wonder, though, Obama's going to have the capacity to really mobilize people. The horrible Hillary, my dad calls her the dragon lady.
Does he really?
Yeah.
You're a sweet father.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
He wrote, he's ancient, but he just wrote Obama and made an offer to... travel to, what do you call this, the retirement villages and homes to talk to the elderly, to tell them to get out and vote for Obama.
He did?
Yeah.
Now we know where you got it.
Right. All right. If you got it, or even if you don't, give us a call. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
We'll be right back.
This is WRIF.com. Friday, May 16th, the finals of the 2008 Riff Rock Girl Search, featuring the return of Filter. With special guest, Greg. Vote for your favorite now at WRAF.com. Then, see the final four contestants at the Royal Oak Music Theater. As the next Riff Rock Girl is chosen. Doors open at 7 p.m. All ages welcome. Free tickets still available. Get them at the Royal Oak Music Theater box office. Old tickets.com outlets. Online at tickets.com. AEGlive.com. Or charge at 800-919-6272. Transportation provided by Love Dodge Limousines. Call 800-LIMO for you. Or click on LABDAS.com. Hair and makeup provided by Six Salon, where it's all about you. In Royal Oak, Birmingham. In their newest location inside the MGM Grand Detroit Casino and Hotel. WRIF's 2008 Riff Rock Girl Finals. Featuring Filter with special guest Red. Live in concert. Friday, May 16th. Brought to you by Bud Light. Bud Light keeps it coming. Wireless Toys. Your cellular superstore. And 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Tears to a smile, it's a brand new day. WYF.com.
All right, $9 million.
For all of you who have stuck with me.
Divided by 900,000 citizens.
Through very difficult times.
$10 a head. Now, you're not getting much more out of these guys.
I'm sorry.
Good thing you can still text message us at the RIF. Get your request, concert info, and your unfair cellular advantage. Text keyword WRIF to 71913. And,
I'm sorry.
We'll never be embarrassed to hear from you.
I would never quit on you.
Log on to WRIF.com for more details. 101 WRIF.
My phone blowing up.
When you were here before, couldn't look you in the eye. Just like an angel, your skin makes me cry. You float like a feather.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much and welcome back. Jalene Jordan is with me. Yeah, I see stuff like on the internet or in the paper that I think most people don't even give a look at. Like if you saw worker productivity up at 2.2% in first quarter, would you...
You'd think, oh, well, this is good news.
But most people wouldn't even bother to read it because what the hell does that even mean? Well, I'll tell you what. It means that we're working hard. And that's what essentially what it says. Worker productivity rose by a better-than-expected amount in the first 3 months of the year while labor cost pressures eased. Now,
okay. This
is, here, I don't know if you need an interpreter for this, but essentially what it says is labor cost pressures eased. It's interesting that they're using that language because I always talk about how we sell our labor as a commodity. So it costs, and what the owners are always trying to do is drive down their expenses, drive down the cost of our labor, in other words, cut our wages. Labor Department reported Wednesday that productivity, the amount of output per hour work, increased at an annual rate of 2.2, you know, it says in the headline, higher than expected, and a sign that inflation could be easing. Labor cost pressures slowed a bit. Unit labor costs rose an annual rate of 2.2, down from 2.8% rise in the final 3 months of the last year. So, in other words, we're working harder and not getting rewarded appropriately for it. Now, here's where the blackmail of the system comes in. And this is what it says in this AP report. While rising wages and benefits are good for employees, don't we all want better bennies and a little more money for what we do. I mean, standing there in the factory, standing there in sitting there in the office, we all deserve more money. Those increases can lead to a higher inflation if businesses are forced to boost the cost of their products to cover the higher payroll costs. So this is the blackmail. They say if you want more money, essentially the value of your raise is going to be eroded by inflation because you are driving up the cost of goods and services because you want a decent wage for you and your family. However, if productivity is increasing, it allows businesses to finance higher wages out of the increased output, which they never do. Right. So this is just a big lie here.
It's twisted stuff, that's for sure.
Yeah. Let's see. Here's Joe in Hamtramck. Joe, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us on WRIF. Good. What's up?
No, I just want to talk to you. I called. I've been on midnight, so they put me out of different shifts, so I'll finally get to listening again. But the deal is that American Axle strike with Mr. Dauch trying to cut the boys' wages in half, and it seems like GM's behind it again, taking away the American workers, trying to bust the union.
Well, no, they're always trying to bust the unions because unions, they add to, what do they call, labor cost pressure. But I thought that GM had offered to put in something like $200 million to help American Axle make a settlement with the UAW.
Well, the deal is, though, that they want to do it for the buyouts only so that the guys will take the $14, $15, $16 an hour jobs. And then offer them buyouts, and then the rest of the workers beyond that will be stuck making $14, $15 an hour. an incentive, in essence, break the UAW union and get a fingers against it. And we here at Hamtramck are really losing. These guys not working. I was a councilman in 97. We gave him a $10 million tax abatement to get this guy rolling, Mr. Dowk. And I didn't know he was going to roll into another country and try to shut these workers down and keep our parking lots empty again. It's just terrible.
Sure, it is. And why the UAW? Why they don't learn? You know, there was supposed to be a huge labor rally in downtown Detroit. I mean, this is supposed to be a labor town. There's hundreds of thousands of us that belong to labor unions and enough other people that understand that labor leads the way in terms of setting wage standards and working conditions and what have you, and that all of us have a stake in having the American Axle UAW workers win. So why in the world would Ev Gettelfinger have canceled Jalene and my show? Oh, no, that was another story.
Oh, wait, that's right.
No, no.
We've been fired by Gettelfinger. So.
No, can I forget? But I'll never forget.
We've got that one on the shelf.
But anyway, why would he have canceled a rally, a big major labor rally? When in the world is organized labor going to show its muscle in the way that the International Longshoremen and Warehouse Union workers did on May 1st when they walked out, shut down all the ports in the West Coast demanding an end to the war in Iraq? I mean, Gettelfinger is going to be out of a job. I mean, it's not going to be a UAW.
You're not right, man, and it's tough. I agree with you. He should put his foot forward. I'm a Teamster also, 29 years, and we're facing the same tough things. You know, Mr. Hoff is trying to do what he can do, but it's the people that got to rally together. All anti, a lot of people are getting anti-union. They forgot how these wages got to where they are. We had to fight for years and years, and people before us had to fight. And it's just sad. There should be more people like you to understand both sides of the story. Everybody wants to make money, but Mr. Dowk's be a little greedy, I think.
I do. I do think that as well.
You have a great day, my friend.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. Here's Andrew in St. Clair Shores. Andrew, hi. It's Peter and Jalene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, hey, I was just wondering about the election. What do you think about it?
What do you mean? What do I think about it?
Who's going to win?
Who's going to win?
Yeah, who's going to win? That's enlightening.
What do you think?
I don't know. I think Obama.
Yeah.
But here is the problem.
Are you old enough to vote yet?
Oh, no.
No. Well, it's good that you're young and thinking about it, though.
Yeah.
Do you ever have, you know, while you're in school, they have mock elections?
Oh, yeah.
You know, when I was probably your age, or how, can I ask you how old you are?
Yeah, I'm 13.
13, yeah. Well, exactly. When I was about 13, we had an election, and I organized about seven other kids to vote for a socialist party that was on,
on
the ballot. And let me see, there was 30. So I went, you know, I went to school in the area, so it was heavily Democratic. So they, let me see, well, it was Miss Patton too, and she said, here are the results. There were, I'm trying to make this come out correctly. She said, there were, I've got to come out to 22. So there was like 14 people that voted for the Democratic president and eight people voted for the Republican. So that only came up to 22. So I raised my hand and I said, and eight of us had voted for the socialists. And I said, Miss Patton, aren't there 30 of us in the class? She said, eight were invalid votes, which was a little demonstration of democracy. They completely ignored it. Well, here's what I think, Andrew. If it was just straight up on the issues and what policies are there, it could be a wipeout. It could be something, you know, like 1972 or something. You know,
where Obama will win by a landslide.
Yeah, so. But you got to remember, these Republicans, they usually win by dirty tricks, by cheating, by vote suppression.
The Supreme Court.
Supreme Court, the manipulation of these electronic voting machines. So I don't think it's a sure thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You guys talk about it a lot in school?
Well, we did it a little back.
Yeah.
Now I'm just like, keep on thinking about it, like, so when I'm older, I know.
I think that's fabulous.
Well, Andrew, thank you. So, do you have school tomorrow?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I can never stay up this late.
Well,
you're lucky.
I'm exhausted. You're still awake. Youth.
But thank you, Andrew. And call
all
us
right.
again. I appreciate you calling into the broadcast.
Yeah, and if you can't stay up to listen, you can always listen on a podcast at WRIF.com and get all the good information.
Yeah, the podcasts have not been, in fact, I think the last podcast we have up is April 27th, but we've just worked out a deal where they're probably going to be up right after the show.
A new system.
A new system.
Great.
We got into play. Yeah, because,
great.
I mean, everybody, and I'm not being critical of anyone, because people really work hard around here, and people have so many duties, and their productivity has gone up about 10 or 20%, so sometimes they can't get it on the site. And you can go to my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. And there's not, let me see. I actually have the front page here. Oh, yeah. Vincent Bugliosi, the guy that prosecuted Charles Manson.
Yeah, we've interviewed him.
No, that's right.
And he also sent me that CD he produced, the greatest Latin love songs of all time. Remember that?
I forgot all about that. Yeah. Well, he's also written an essay, which is on my website, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. And,
wow.
Yeah. So there's a lot of pretty interesting. And if you're wondering where your tax dollars go, there's a good link there. It says, give friends and family a $3 trillion gift certificate. And it shows where our tax dollars go in Michigan. And then if you're listening on the Internet, that gives that as well. And I always have here. Yeah, I'm almost tempted to take this off. The American GI death toll in Iraq, Bush's Slaughtergate.
What is it now?
Well, as of May 10th, 4,073. And these are just numbers here.
And these are for U.S. soldiers.
Yeah.
It's not including civilians.
Oh, the Iraqi civilians, who knows? I mean, somewhere between 100,000 and million, millions and millions of displaced people there. Warfare inside of a city. That, you know, that was interesting. That apparently there is a truce between the Iraqi government and leaders of the movement of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. They agreed yesterday to a truce, and it was brokered with help from Iran.
I really had a hard time wrapping my brain around this one.
Well, the Iraqi government and Iran are great pals. President Ahmadinejad goes and visits the Iraqi government.
He vacations in Baghdad?
Yeah, al-Maliki. Okay. Yeah, they're both Shiites. And what the Iranians, are, to the extent that they are, and I have no idea, because you can't tell from the U.S. government, because all they've ever done about the Middle East is lie, that how much Iran is meddling. I mean, meddling is a verb which is not real strong. I mean, here you have this American occupation force of 135,000, 150,000 that has had probably 500,000 men over there, suffered grievous losses, and done horrible damage to the country and its citizens. And they call Iranians who are on the border, have a direct border with Iraq, meddling. I don't get that. The Iranians helped end the standoff by throwing their weight behind the al-Maliki government. After a delegate of Shiite members of parliament visited Iran earlier this month. So,
I don't know. This is scary.
It is. And the U.S. essentially is just one of the many militias fighting in this many-sided civil war.
Yeah. May I say big-ass militia? Yeah. That, yeah.
Here's David in Dearborn. David, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, what's up? I got some comments about just about a couple of the subjects that have been covered so far.
Sure.
Back to, like, the, you know, unions and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Something interesting. Okay. Black Lake, Michigan. Have you ever heard of it?
Yeah, sure. Okay. It's a UAW camp or a resort and rest area.
Huge. They built a mansion for every single one of the UAW presidents, and they tear it down after the guy dies. If union workers want to know where their money's going, it's going down a giant black hole called Black Lake.
Well, let me tell you this. First, Black Lake, along with the IE America Radio Network, the airline that they bought, and also Rancho something or other.
Oh, I remember the airline.
California. It was a terrible mistake. But the thing about building them a mansion and tearing it down, and that's just nuts. I don't know where you heard that.
It's insane. Okay, my property up there.
Yeah.
Property for my family up there. Right next door. You can walk through there. You can walk through it. Sure. Okay. I'll admit it's trespassing. But when you see the kind of money that they have wasted, it's just downright insulting. My grandfather worked for Ford for 50 years, and I am just really peeved that that's where his money went.
Well, you know, in fairness, these were thought of as investments that would benefit both the unions and the union members. The Black Lake is supposed to be a place where UAW members, it is, where UAW members can go at much, much reduced rates. And I mean, sort of like it was supposed to be, you know, like Mayor Hubbard of Dearborn created Camp Dearborn out near Milford. The only thing is that they, you're absolutely right, is that they turned out to be fairly, they turned out to be real bad investments. I was joking before about the UAW canceling the show that Jalene and I did together from about, actually not about, but from 2000 to 2003, and it turned out to be a terrible investment as well. They lost about $12 million. The idea was to get labor ideas across, but unfortunately people like myself and Jalene and Mike Malloy and Tom Hartman were what I've been calling lately premature Bush haters. So rather than it expanding and creating the possibilities of a large network that had did really well, we lost station after station after station. And I have to say that firing us and closing closing the network financially was not bad at all, because when you lose that kind of money, you know, you've got to take some serious steps. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. But again, the thing about the mansion is just nuts. Absolutely. All right, I'm gonna go a minute or two early, because if I take one of you that are waiting at 313-298-WRIF, now you'll only get a very, very short time to talk. So we'll be back with our second hour. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
This is WRIF.com. It's your big shot at nabbing a 2008 Harley-Davidson XL1200N Sportster Nightster, courtesy of Motor City Harley-Davidson. A two-year lease on a 2008 Dodge Ram 1500 Quad Cab Laramie 4x4, courtesy of Oakland Dodge. A trip for two to Harley-Davidson's 105th anniversary celebration, Labor Day weekend in Milwaukee, courtesy of Miller Lite. And $500 worth of gas to get you there. Compliment to the rim. Keep it tuned to 101 WRIF to win $50 in free gas, plus a key to these sweet wheels and more. June 14th at Freedom Hill in Sterling Heights. Also, listen for details on Harley Bike Nights around the Motor City, where you can win a key in person. Think you can handle the rush? Harley Fest 2008, presented by Motor City Harley-Davidson. Feel the freedom at the number one dealer in Farmington Hills. Also presented by Miller Lite. Miller Lite, bigger, bolder, summer, Oakland Dodge, and your Harley Fest 2008 station, 101 WRIF. Every good rush.
RiffsPhone.com.
The Riff satisfies your need for speed with racing action that rocks. Memorial Day weekend rocks as 101, WRIF, and Firestone present exclusive IMS Radio Network coverage of the 92nd running of the Indianapolis 500. Sunday, May 25th, starting at noon. In 2008, 101, WRIF is your home for Indianapolis Motor Speedway Network race coverage. From the green all the way to the checkered flag. The granddaddy of them all. The Indianapolis 500, live from the Brickyard. Presented by Firestone. Firestone, presenting sponsor of the Detroit Indy Grand Prix on 101 WRIF. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour. Jalene Jordan is with me. And if I can find, oh yeah, here it is. Tonight at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, Utah Phillips. Actually, we're going to start with.
Really?
Yeah. He's, well, let me we'll do it in order. First one is going to be with James Gustav Speth, who is a dean at Yale University, talking about the bridge at the edge of the world, capitalism, the environment, and crossing from crisis to sustainability. Another one of these mainstream guys. I can't remember how mainstream he was. I say it at the beginning of the interview. But another one of these guys that's just been radicalized by reality.
Yeah. This reality will do it to you, won't it?
Yeah. And then Utah Phillips, who's a singer-songwriter and a troubadour of the industrial workers of the world, the IWW. You go to IWW.org. Utah Phillips, there's going to be a benefit for him this Wednesday in Ann Arbor at the ARC. Wonderful venue on Main Street downtown there. And Utah Phillips is not doing very well. He's actually has a catheter into his heart. And
I didn't know that.
He can't perform anymore.
Aww.
So there's going to be Garnett Rogers, WDET's Matt Watroba, McLean, Chris Buhalis, Len Wallace from Windsor, and it's going to be at the ARC, 316 South Main. Tickets are $20 at the, you can go to Ticketmaster, ARC box office as well. Or you can go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com. Click on the calendar. I'll be there. And Utah has done incredible work and interesting guy. Tells us a lot of stories of life on the road, late 40s and early 50s, on the interview that I did with him. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Call talkyes at yahoo.com, which we haven't even looked at, have we? I was thinking about Andrew from St. Clair Shores, the 13-year-old that called in, and he was asking about politics and what we think is going to happen. And I think unless it's close, when it's close, the Republicans can steal it like they did for the last two. But I suspect that old grumpy Grandpa McSame is probably going to get trounced. And unless they engineer something really big.
And they're so good at it.
Okay. So here's Obama. He's the president. And he is protected by the Secret Service, right?
Oh, yeah.
Here's the problem. Secret Service supervisors shared crude sexual jokes and engaged in racially derogatory banter about blacks and passed around an anecdote about the possible assassination of Reverend Jesse Jackson. This is according to internal emails disclosed in a federal filing. There's a lawsuit by black Secret Service agents, been hanging around the suit for 8 years, claiming that they haven't been promoted, because they've been denied promotions unfairly. Now, what evidence do they have? Well, here you go. The filing includes 10 email messages that were among documents the agency recently turned over to lawyers for the black agents as part of an increasingly bitter discrimination lawsuit. The messages were written were sent to and from email accounts of at least 20 Secret Service supervisors, not low-level doofuses, but the guys that are responsible for the protection of the President of the United States. So here you have these guys involved in racist banter, and if that definition doesn't work as describing someone as a racist, I don't know what does. I mean, why do white people think all this black stuff is so funny? I mean, what is with people that do that?
Yeah, I don't understand it at all. The differences are funny. It's just ignorance.
Yeah.
Well,
in its highest form.
White people have always been fascinated by black people. If you go back into the 19th century and minstrel shows and all that, and the role that black actors were forced into.
Like blackface and things like that.
Well, in the minstrel shows, but then when they were always, in films up through probably the 60s when Sidney Poitier and others started appearing in roles that had respect connected with them. They were always, Charlie Chan's manservant people in Gone with the Wind.
Shameful.
It is. The disclosure of these racist messages follows an incident last month in which a noose was found in a room used by a black instructor at a Secret Service training facility in Maryland. And they said the episode was under investigation. So here is a man training people to protect the President of the United States and other officials, and you have Secret Service agents involved in this racist behavior. The senders of the email are identified only by the jobs they currently occupy and the rank they held when the messages were sent. For example, a message referring to a Harlem spelling bee,
this is so bad,
ridiculing black slang, was sent by Thomas Grupsky, and then Assistant Director for Protective Operations, who, according to the filing, now heads the Office of Government Liaison and Public Affairs.
So once again, they land on their feet, even though they've done such horrible, 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 horrible things.
And joking about Reverend Jesse Jackson being killed by a missile in a plane he's...
Right.
Yeah, I mean, these people, they're some sick puppies to begin with. And there are, unfortunately, a remnant of really sick white people who take, I don't know, the stress, the frustration, the rage, all the negative emotions that angry men can mobilize and fasten it on African-American people. And they're going to be protecting a man who is half African-American.
That's right.
This is pretty scary.
Well, I hope that Obama has read that. And you know, if I hear one more person say, and I don't mean to be racist by saying this, I'm going to scream.
Well, people know. Actually, I can't imagine he's listening. I was playing handball the other night, and one guy we play with, who isn't one of our friends, he said, you want to hear a racial joke? And
there was racial?
Racial, he said.
Okay.
And this friend of mine and I said, no, we don't want to hear it at all. He says, come on. He says, this black kid and a white kid. I said, We are going to think less of you if you tell this joke. And he started saying, well, I don't know why people are so sensitive. I just walked out of the court. And I guess,
good for you.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean.
And people are up in arms because everyone's too politically correct. Well, you know what? I think it's okay to be too politically correct. I don't think you can be too politically correct.
That's right.
And sensitive when it comes to issues like racial issues.
Disrespecting people.
Right.
All right, 313-298-WRIF. Here, I can't make out this name real well, but hi, you're on the air. Who's this? Hello? What? Hello? Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Hi. Who's this?
Hey, this is Will Hoyt, Private Will Hoyt.
Private Willie?
Will Hoyt.
Will Hoyt.
Oh,
okay,
Will.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Will. You're on the air.
No big deal. Hi, I just came back from Honduras today, actually, with the Army. We're down there. It's Operation Beyond the Horizons. They're like building schools and whatnot. And I was kind of curious to touch bases with you as far as what you thought with U.S. relations with the foreign military and whatnot.
Well, it's been pretty awful. We've, at the School of the Americas, whatever it's called now, have trained generations of torturers. And I agree with Ron Paul. Get the U.S. out of every foreign base. We shouldn't. Why? I mean, what other country has foreign bases all over the world, and for what?
Well, it's not actually a U.S. base down there. It's a Honduran base that we're working on, and we're joined up with the Hondurans down there, working alongside with them as far as training goes, and. Like I said, they're down there, especially in a lot of the poorer areas, building schools, latrines, storage facilities, water towers, giving fresh water and all kinds of stuff. And I personally think that they're doing a really good job down there. And I just kind of curious as to anything about it.
It's the left hand giveth the right hand supports a military which is a horrible history of being of repression towards its own citizens. The United States, for the last 100 and something years, has played an awful role in in Central and South America, supporting the worst dictatorships, training the worst elements of these Latin American armies, and maybe in a way make up for it, do a little of that, but I don't think it's ever without intent to make sure that that the governments of those countries continue to have governments that will support American corporate interests over the interests of the people of that country and that region.
Mm-hmm. Do you know anything in regards to the Honduran government and, like, as far as where it stands and how it operates?
I don't know right now. I mean, it's formally a democracy. I mean, during the 1980s, it was a torture state that was right. backed by the Reagan administration. I haven't been out of the news, hopefully, for good reasons lately.
Okay.
Do you know anything about it?
Personally, no. That's kind of why I was asking. We didn't really touch much base with us down there when we were down there on it, but... No, I just kind of skimming the surface on that, see if you knew anything about it, or as far as any other countries that we might have been in doing, like, civil service and whatnot.
Well, I know, for instance, I think it's the Ecuadorian government that there's an American base there, an air base, and the U.S. wants to renew it, and the Ecuadorian government says, we'll allow that if you allow us, the Ecuadorians, to have a base in Florida of their air force.
Oh, my.
So, yeah, I don't like that idea.
Well, that's not going to happen. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about it.
There's 700 bases that the United States has around the world. And if there's reason for very many of them, I can't figure it out. Like I said, Ron Paul, I agree with him. He can't figure it.
So you haven't been to Iraq?
No, I have not.
Okay. I mean, I'm even surprised to hear about anything else going on in the world, that there are even resources left to send you to South America.
All right. Well, thank you. I'm going to look up about the Honduran government. Appreciate your call. We were talking earlier about, this is a little long distance. Ted in Ann Arbor. Hi, Ted. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jalene. How are you doing tonight?
We're doing good.
Great.
I have a couple of quick comments, and then I'll let you guys discuss them.
Sure.
First of all, as far as the union goes, the union are really controlled by the big and the rich anymore. I've actually sat down and talked to Ron Gettelfinger. A good friend of mine was the president of the UAW at a local plant at Woodhaven, and sitting around the round table, I proposed, before this contract talk, I said, why don't you negotiate into the contract that the UAW workers keep their taxes all year, and then at the end of the year, they invest that into a fund where the interest goes into their 401k, and at the end of the year, instead of them getting a refund back from the IRS, they just simply pay in what they owe.
How can you can't withhold your taxes.
Why can't you? You're only loaning the government or loaning the IRS your money until they figure out what you owe. They hold it 16 months, and then they cut you back what you've overpaid.
Yeah, but it's withholding tax. You don't have any control over it.
Why do we need to loan them in advance?
Well,
that's a really good question.
Well, whether we should or shouldn't is one thing, but the fact is we don't have any control over it.
Well, you do have control over it.
How?
I'm self-employed, and I pay my taxes at the end of the year. I don't withhold taxes from my check.
Well, if you're self-employed, yeah, but as an employee, and myself and Jalene, we can't control the rate of withholding. That's determined by that whatever form you file and how many dependents. And,
right, but but think about it. You get a tax refund at the end of the year for money that you've overpaid.
Right. Essentially what you're doing, when you say, I'm getting $800 back, that's your money, and essentially you've made an interest-free loan to the government. Well, I remember about 20 years ago, I figured, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put down that I have 15 dependents, and so they'll take out almost nothing, and I'll leave all that money in a bank. It wasn't like I was going to invest in stocks. I didn't have it. Clueless how to do that, but I would, sit in a bank savings account and get about 3-4% interest. And so, in fact, that happened, and I probably made, I don't know what the hell I made, it wasn't that much, but then I had to write, a check. Ronald Reagan, like $6,108, even though I probably made $150, $175, It was terrible. I had to write a check this time. George W. Bush. Actually, it was fortunately it was a few hundred. Yeah.
You did?
Yeah. It hurt.
Ugh, that is that hurts.
Thanks,
all the way over here.
Yeah, it does. It does. Let's see. Here is Mohammed in Dearborn. Mohammed, hi. It's Peter and Jolene.
Hey, Peter. Jolene, how you doing?
Good.
Long time no talk.
What's
hey,
happening?
I was calling in reference about that guy that was talking about that Black Lake Resort.
The UAW.
Conway, Michigan. The
yeah.
UAW Resort.
Right.
Now, that resort, it is actually for the UAW members. So they have something to, you know, go up north. Some of, you know, not everybody has land and property up there. So something nice to do. And also what they do is they have classes over there to get union members behind the union and to educate them. I think it's an awesome thing. I mean, look, we work, we break our backs in those factories, in those shops, and I think we do deserve a little something. You know,
I agree. Let me say that. Let me say, I don't think I kind of lumped Black Lake in with a bunch of really bad financial investments that were made by the UAW. And I don't think Black Lake, I'll have to clean that up here. Black Lake does not deserve to be lumped in that, because Black Lake does not have to operate as a at a profit, because as you're saying, Mohammed, it's in fact, they call it, don't they? It's like Black Lake Educational.
Yeah, the William, it's the William P. William, and I forget what it is, the Reuther.
Yeah.
William Reuther Family Education.
Walter.
Yeah.
We have, I mean, Walter Reuther. Walter and May Reuther Education Center, or something. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you're right. I think things can operate at a loss. Like, there's a number of things that should operate at a loss that should be subsidized publicly, for instance, like transportation. You know, that there ought to be massive government subsidies instead of pouring it into the black hole of the war machine, that we ought to have heavily subsidized mass transit, for instance, a rail system that's worthy of a country that says it's a great nation as opposed to a disgraceful one, and on and on. So, yeah, I agree that Black Lake is a worthy facility. All right, Mohammed, thank you very much. I don't know if I ever told you that my mother and father were good friends with Walter and May Reuther.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Except it's interesting. My mother and May Reuther had a deal that while they were together, they couldn't talk about union business or politics. So
that had to have been difficult.
Well, they didn't. And any time they'd start, the two women would say, come on, you know the deal. So here they were with one of the key people of the mid 20th century. And yeah.
Wow. like my dad and I, my dad, the Republican, we talk about birds.
There you go. They're coming back. I heard the warblers.
Right.
I heard the warblers. You know what I got to do? Oh, man. I'm terrible. People.
Okay. What he's saying is he hasn't checked his email.
And I'm just looking at how many of you have written in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Why do I give the... let me see. So... I don't know. Never mind. Ha ha. Hey, Peter, why is it always when you start talking about Republicans, there is always someone wanting to defend them? The caller belongs on the front line.
On the
front line. Yeah, I got you. Okay.
Well, we get a lot of that.
We do. Here's Brian in Waterford. Brian, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you?
We're good.
Good. Well, I was listening to your comments regarding the unions, and my grandfather is a local IBEW 58 for 60 years.
Okay.
So I know that side of the story. What I'm not 100% sure on, and don't want to make a fool of myself on your show, but
we do it all the time. We get paid.
Well, I hear a lot of comments about, you know, the Chinese, and they don't have unions, and they're basically taking manufacturing jobs away from the greatest manufacturing country in the world. And the unions are continuing to increase, you know, and fight for more, for higher wages for their employees, and we can't compete with the Chinese for manufacturing jobs. So I guess, what's your take on that?
Well, it's what I said. That's part of the blackmail, is if you want decent wages, if you want to maintain the wage standards that people have fought and literally died for over the last 100-something years, you're going to jeopardize your job. So, what, you know, sort of, we're back to the 19th century, right? Where we're going to be, we're going to take whatever the employer offers us and be happy that we get that. And all the conditions will be set by him or it in terms of a corporation. The working standards, the working conditions, the benefits, if there are any. Because they'd like to get rid of that all. And suddenly the 19th century, which we always talk about as being the dark age of labor with child labor and 12, 14, sometimes 16-hour days under the most unsafe and unsanitary conditions, that's what's happening in Asia now. That's what happens in some places in Latin America. But what that means is less cost to them, and the less that they pay out, the more money they have for themselves and their stockholders. So we're going to be blackmailed on an international level. And there's some grotesque truth to that. If we demand the rewards from the productivity that we put into our labor, well, yeah, they're going to think, why should I pay? And they do that. Why should I, you know, Ford thinks this. Why should I pay somebody $25-$30 an hour when I can have, when I have a Ford plant in, you know, Micheladores in Mexico where I'm paying people 10% of that? I mean, the only reason that Ford just doesn't send everything to Mexico is that they fortunately realize they probably sink the state of Michigan, and they have some vested interest in that. But the more they can get people to work cheaply, the more that they can set us against one another, the more that, that they can evaluate the cost of, or value the cost of our labor like we're potatoes. In other words, the more the larger the crop, the less it's worth per unit. You know, that capitalism is the only system that's ever been developed where a good harvest is not welcome because that'll drive the price down. So, when you have many workers competing among themselves for the positions that are available, and now worldwide, well, what the hell? Why not have a world wage standard of about $2 an hour, right?
Well, that's what Walmart is doing currently.
Yeah, exactly.
But, and I don't support their stores, but at this point I'm, you know, beginning to feel the same way about the other way is, you know, the automakers pay too much. There's got to be a balance somewhere in between the two.
How do you figure what's too much?
Well, that's a good question.
You ever worked in a factory? I never have. I know people that have. Lots of my friends have, and I've toured them on probably under the best conditions. I mean, those people should be making about $150,000 a year, easy.
Yeah.
For doing that kind of work.
Some, and some of them are.
Well, I don't think they're making that much. But if they are, they're working 60, 70, 80 hours a week. I mean, the people that, was it you? Yeah, it was you that said you, somebody in your family was an IBEW?
Yes.
Yeah. I just actually, now that you mention it, I just had lunch on Thursday with the president of the IBEW, and you may or may not have heard an ad I did for them, the cooperation they're having with the contractors to have union labor. Because what unions do is they artificially raise the selling price of labor above the market valuation of it. I don't know if that makes a lot of sense. But again, if you allow wages to be determined by the market, like they were in the 19th century and up until the 1930s, people made crappy wages that all went to the owners. The owners, if you look worldwide and the kind of wealth that they have, this small sliver of men have a net worth in the trillions. That I can't remember what it is, something like 1% of the Earth's population owns like 50-60% of the wealth, and the bottom 50% own 1% of it. So this is this monstrous class system that impoverishes billions of people, and that is beginning to fray around the edges. See, we were always in the northern tier countries. We were in the first, the first world. We were the developed nations. Well, that's beginning to fray. And we're seeing the leading edge of it a lot of different places. And the model for labor is going to wind up to be Asia, where you're going to be lucky to have a job. All right. Thank you, my friend. I appreciate it. Don't get sucked in by all that anti-labor stuff. One thing that labor does, it is the foremost bulwark against the attack on wages and benefits and living standards and working conditions. Because labor always has a political agenda that they want to exercise through the Democratic Party. And if you ever look at it, if you look at what pieces of legislation they want, there's nothing that benefits only unionized workers. There's nothing that benefits only unionized workers. Every piece of legislation that America's unions want benefits everyone that works for a wage, whether you're white collar, blue collar, fast food, whatever. I can't understand opposition to unions by working people. Unions also, what, every statistic, every unionized workers make more money, got better benefits, on and on and on like that. All right, 313-298-WRIF, and here's Tyler. Tyler's in Commerce Township. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I wanted to take on the fact of, like, the Iraq War. Like, why does Bush, instead of focusing on Iraq, why not go to, like, the genocide in Iraq, which is a lot more horrors in all of Africa than there is in just a few countries like Iraq?
Oh, so what you're saying is why doesn't he go help other people who need it in other countries, like in Africa, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. Because he's
not interested in helping anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
This ain't about helping anybody. It's about stealing other people's oil. It's about maintaining an empire. It's about
giving money to his corporate buddies.
Yeah, justifying an enormous $1 trillion a year war budget. Where, as I was just saying earlier, things are beginning to fray here, and already we see the infrastructure in trouble, which needs hundreds of billions of dollars. So,
to put it lightly, he's a bad guy.
Yeah, and he has bad intentions, and it represents the worst in this society. That's what I would
say. It's a good question, though.
All right, yes. Thank you. Appreciate it. Let's see. Here is Lars. Lars is in Madison Heights. Lars, hi. It's Peter and Jolene.
Hi, Peter and Jolene.
Hi.
Hey, Lars.
I'd like to talk about a mental health issue that deeply affects American policy.
Sure.
Less than 1% of Americans are schizophrenic, yet they represent one of the most powerful voting blocs in the country.
What?
When you take into account multiple personalities, they represent roughly 1/3 of the popular vote.
you had us going there.
On national defense, they think it's important that the United States prevents Al-Qaeda from gaining access to Iraqi ports, which might be used to launch stealth submarines against the U.S.
Yeah.
On the economy, keeping communist spies from France from sabotaging the economy so we can be taken over by Canada. On religion, the more supported issue, killing people who don't follow the teachings of Jesus or even return his phone calls.
I'm telling you, stand-up is next for you, Lars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it took me a while to write that down.
That was pretty good.
Thank you, Lars.
We'll give you that one.
Appreciate your call.
Or our talk show. He could have a future.
I love bits.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, no. Wait a minute. We're going to encourage people. No bits.
No bits.
That was very unique. All right. Here's Chris and Warren. Chris, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
As always, thank you for taking my call, guys.
Sure.
This is one of your favorite callers in on nighttime, always willing to share my opinion, what I think about things.
Okay.
For one, I'd like to congratulate the little 13-year-old for being probably one of the honest callers that you've had through some of the night, at least, because some of these other people always flavor up their calls. I don't know how ever you want to take it, but I always enjoy your guys' show. You go from one topic to another, but I wanted to touch base on the subject that you discussed earlier about the issue with Myanmar.
Sure.
Okay. As I'm doing a little research on it, I've noticed that U.S., of course, is going to always provide foreign aid to these countries or so. But when is it going to be where we have other people, whether it's the U.S., Arab Emirates, all these oil executives, all these other foreign countries and these people of high status that will provide funding
basically what I'm saying is I'm just frustrated, kind of pissed off that everybody's always thinking that we have to be the sovereign state to provide the funding to these people. And don't get me wrong, I'm a Catholic by heart, and I don't wish cruel things upon anybody, as well as I'm sorry this devastation happened, but we got our own problems in our own state, in our own nation.
Well, yeah, I think this is kind of special, and we'd have money for stuff like that. I mean, the world is awash in wealth. There's no reason for poverty, for wars, for disease. This is because there is such intense concentration of wealth in the hands of a relatively few number of men. I can't remember what it is, like 1,000 billionaires or a million billionaires. We're talking about a world with 6 billion people. And we have a situation where these people could, instead of buying, I remember I was talking last week about that painting by Francis Bacon that's going to go for, I think, like $20 million.
Oh, yeah, but then there was the $3 billion home.
What? That's right. So we're not even, that just what this one guy is going to pay for a painting is more than the U.S. is offering. Myanmar and all this incredible catastrophic devastation. So the money's there. But what it shouldn't come out of is my taxes, your taxes, our community's taxes, but rather have a fair distribution of wealth throughout the world, and we wouldn't be looking at the misery that is presented to us. All right, thank you very much. One email here to read. Ron writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I'm from Canada and consider myself way to the left, not as far as we are. And I was watching.
Thank you.
The old. No. I said that. That was a little parenthesis. Yeah.
I thought it was a compliment.
Anyways, Ron was watching the O'Reilly Factor this week to see the nutty stuff that douche mumbles on about, and he was interviewing John McSame. And that's McCain, if you're just joining us. Grumpy Grandpa McSame. And he said that he did vote for Bush in both 2000 and 2004, just letting you know.
Okay.
Because there's a big Arianna Huffington and a couple of actors from West Wing said that they were there when John McCain in 2000, after the election, said he did not vote for Bush. Remember, Bush's people put out all this racist crap about his saying what? That he had an illegitimate black daughter or something like that?
Oh, I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah. They're such scum.
They really are. And you know what? And McCain, McInsane, he can say anything he wants and backtrack and, you know.
Yeah, how can you prove it?
Exactly.
All right, we'll be right back with our final segment, and that goes till 1 a.m. when the interviews begin, so stay with us. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
Listening to WRIF.com.
Great live rock, awesome bikes, cold beer, hot days. And for the 10th anniversary, we've taken it up another notch. 101 WRIF, Miller Lite, and Oakland Dodge present the 10th annual Motor City Harley-Davidson Harley Fest. Saturday, June 19th at Freedom Hill in Sterling Heights, featuring live rock all day long, including Days of the New. Pop Evil, plus the Howling Diablos, Ashes of Soma, and many more. Plenty of vendors, food, the best in bike show, and tons of free stuff to do all day long. You'll get all the details you need right now at WRIF.com. Saturday, June 14th at Freedom Hill in Sterling Heights. The 10th annual Motor City Harley-Davidson's Harley Fest. Feel the freedom at the number one dealer in Farmington Hills. Also presented by Miller Lite. Miller Lite. Bigger. Bolder. Summer. Oakland Dodge. And your Harley Fest 2008 station. 101 WRIF. Every rocks.
Make up your mind. Decide to walk with me around the lake tonight. Around the lake tonight. Gentlemen,
Friday, May 16th, the finals of the 2008 Riff Rock Girl Search, featuring the return of Future. With special guest, Red. Vote for your favorite now at WRAF.com. Then, see the final four contestants at the Royal Oak Music Theater as the next Riff Rock Girl is chosen. Doors open at 7 p.m. All ages welcome. Free tickets still available. Get them at the Royal Oak Music Theater box office. Old Tickets.com outlets. Online at Tickets.com. AEGLive.com. Or charge at 800-919-6272. Transportation provided by Loftus Limousines. Call 800-LIMO for you. Or click on LABDAS.com. Hair and makeup provided by Six Salon, where it's all about you. In Royal Oak, Birmingham. In their newest locations at the MGM Grand Detroit Casino and Hotel. WRIF's 2008 Riff Rock Girl Finals. Featuring Filter with special guest Red. Live in concert Friday, May 16th. Brought to you by Bud Light. Bud Light keeps it coming. Wireless Toys, your cellular superstore. And 101 WRIF. Ever in that rush. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Angeline Jordan is with me, of course, for about another 20 minutes or so. Then we'll do some interviews that I recorded previously, earlier in the week, with the voice of the industrial workers of the world, Utah Phillips. Benefit for him this coming Wednesday. You can go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. And James Gustav Speth, author of The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability. Well, that's a mouthful.
That sure is.
Yeah. And I got an email here from Paul Pearson. And normally I don't say people's last name, right?
Right.
But Paul Pearson is Paul from Detroit Liberation. They're one of the organizations trying to do marijuana reform. And he says, thanks for coming and speaking at Liberation Day, as I did a week ago Saturday. Mm-hmm. I still haven't heard your speech. I was dealing with a very nice police officer at that time, and my video camera was dead. He says, I read in the New York Times that Congress is looking to close the loopholes that allows Blackwater, KBR, et cetera, contractors in Iraq from using offshore entities in the Cayman Islands to not have to pay income taxes and offer benefits to the U.S. citizens they employ. Are you familiar with this? Well,
hey, Wesley Snipes got busted for it. Why don't they bust these
right.
guys?
Yeah. I'm contacting my congresspersons on Monday in sport. Well, that's good. But you can go to DetroitLiberation.org because people are really waking up to how horrible these drug laws are. And Michigan's going to vote on legalizing marijuana for medical use. It's going to be on the ballot. So all these folks are going to be coming out that are usually, you know, all the stoners going, hey, man, where's the...
There was a didn't Ferndale...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they did. In fact, a number of cities, where is this in here, including Detroit. I thought I had this. This is a long article. Oh, yeah. Five Michigan cities have passed largely symbolic ordinances to allow medical marijuana. Detroit, mm-hmm. Ferndale, Ann Arbor, Flint, and Traverse City. That's nice.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration regards medical marijuana users, even in states that have approved its use, as lawbreakers. And in 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that state laws approving medical marijuana don't bring with them immunity from federal prosecution. But according to Diane Byram of the Michigan Coalition for Compassionate Care, they collected 500,000 petition signatures to get it on the ballot. Says 99% of drug laws are enforced by state law enforcement agencies, and in states with medical marijuana laws, as long as the person is conforming with the state law, there are virtually no arrests.
I told you Snoop Dogg has his license.
Does he?
He does.
He's
got
amazing.
A condition.
U.S. law, it's got a November 4th is when the election is. Puts Michigan at the forefront of the national debate that has percolated since 1996 when California voters approved medical marijuana. And in this article that was in the Detroit News, actually, boy, I didn't realize we had it that long, April 29th, some doctors say it's cool, some say it's don't. I guess the state medical society is going to vote as to whether or not they think it's has medical properties. But what if people think it does? What about these people that have AIDS and cancer and glaucoma and stuff like that? If they think it does, what the hell? I mean, these are...
I mean, it's been proven to, you know, relieve nausea.
Yeah.
People are able to actually eat when they couldn't eat before. And on and on and on.
Right now,
it's
U.S.
exhausting.
It is. U.S. law classifies marijuana, like heroin and LSD, as a Schedule I controlled substance. That means it has a high potential for abuse and no accepted medical use. Well, a couple of things. Heroin is the single best painkiller. That's what it was used for. In fact, not morphine. What the hell? All of a sudden, it's out of my brain. What's used now? I mean, there's lots of different substances they use now.
Like Darvocet Vicodin.
Big stuff, like you get intravenously.
I don't know.
But heroin is a better painkiller by like a factor of five. LSD, that it has a high potential for abuse and has no accepted medical use. Well, it doesn't have high potential for. What do they mean by abuse?
I don't know.
I mean, there's not a lot of people.
Because you have one bad trip and you're done.
There's not a lot of people that have taken a lot of. Like ecstasy is. And one of the things that happens to you with ecstasy, if you start taking it frequently, it loses its capacity to provide the ecstatic state. So it's sort of, that's what Huey, what was that guy? He was not one of my favorite bands, but.
Huey Lewis?
And the News. I want a new drug.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That's an ecstasy song.
Is ecstasy still hot out there, I wonder?
I don't know. What do I know? I told you, I'm just with the drug of despair, alcohol.
Right.
All right. All right, let's go back and get some calls and try to get all of you on the air. Let's see. Here is Howard. Howard's in Jackson, Michigan. Howard, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Pete. Hi, Jolene.
Hi.
Hey, that guy called in about taxes, and I just wanted to clarify what I found out.
Sure.
Withholding's an agreement between the employer and employee. Withhold taxes. There's no set amount. So, like you said, it's just an agreement between the two of you.
Well, you have to file a form. I mean, you have to have you have to agree, though. It may be an agreement between an employer and employee, but there's a federal form that has to be filed, and it has to be consistent, because you can't do what I did 20 years ago, which is to claim 15 dependents and hold on to your money. Because, in fact, if you claim 15 dependents throughout the year, and then at the end of it you say there's only you, there's actually a financial penalty. But the IRS law, for better or for worse, requires you to file this form, and it has to be consistent with your actual status.
Well, a couple years ago, they sent me penalties. I had a penalty attached for not filing. You're not withholding enough.
Right.
And I called it, or I wrote in and argued it, and everything was dropped.
Oh, they dropped it, really?
Are you drag racing right now or something?
I'm working.
Oh, what's...
I work for Chrysler. I'm at the Proving Grounds.
Yeah, you're actually at the Proving Grounds?
Yeah.
And cars are roaring around the track?
Yeah.
Wow.
At 1A, huh?
Yeah.
It's 85.
Oh, no, wait,
at 1 a.m.
She meant at 1 a.m. You're driving
85
miles an hour. Yeah.
24 operations.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks for the info. I appreciate that. Thanks for having joined us. And let's see, here is Josh in West Branch. Boy, we're going all over the state, aren't we? Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter and Jolene.
Hi.
I just want to comment on your where you said, these workers who are making $150,000 in factories. I'm a nurse, and I don't make that much. I mean, I've worked in machine shops, and I don't think that any unskilled labor who can just, basically just pick a transmission up and put it on the line all day or push a press or whatever should be making that kind of money. That's taking the incentive away to go to college and better yourself.
Well, I'll tell you, somebody's got to do that. People don't make $150,000. I say if they're the auto workers that are making up around $100,000, they don't have any life other than working. I mean, the people that I know in the trades and building trades and factory work, these are people that are working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day.
And the conditions often that they have to work under. You deserve more money, too.
Yeah, as a nurse, you've probably come in contact with the results of a lifetime of factory work, what happens to people's bodies, everything from the toxic chemicals they're exposed to just standing on concrete floors. It's not a good job, and they deserve a lot of money for it. But we all do. There's enough wealth in this country to reward us all. And resenting one category of workers because you think they, quote, don't deserve it because it's simple. We deserve to be well waged because we work hard and we produce an enormous amount of wealth for the owners of this society and the owners of the world.
Okay.
Good. We're in agreement then. Thank you. Join a union. They got what are those nurses?
The California Nurses Association.
Yeah. Check them out. Let's see. Here's Jeff in Detroit. Jeff, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete. Hey, Jelaine. How you doing?
Hi.
Hi.
Hey. You know, sometimes I think I'm really crazy because I'm real left of center and.
Not as far as we are.
Well, probably not.
It's tough to do.
I think the world would be such a better place if we had universal health care.
Oh, you do sound like a commie to me.
If college was free for everybody.
You are. You're an anarchist.
You know, that wouldn't that make society better to have healthy, educated people?
Look, Jeff, you know there's...
Don't go getting crazy on us.
As you well know, and here's the country I always use as the model, which is Guatemala. Guatemala, they have a decently waged top third of people that live there. The bottom two-thirds live in abject misery. You know, they're death squads, squalid poverty, no health care, any wage whatsoever. But... the capital, the wealth of that country, circulates among the top third, who live like people in our area, like you do probably and like I do. And they have nice cars and they have nice houses, although, of course, they have to hire bodyguards and they have to have walls with they actually have broken bottles on the top of glass.
In concrete.
Yeah, in concrete, you know, stop the poor from having the temerity to come visit them in an unwarranted manner. So... yeah, it would seem to make sense that you would want to share the commonwealth in a more equitable manner than it currently is, because we wouldn't have a society that has the qualities that Guatemala has, and increasingly, I mean, we don't have death squads, and we don't, yet.
Right.
But, it makes sense. And the thing is, the wealth is here to have a universal health system, to have free college, to have a fully government-funded rapid transit system and rail and every other way manageable, and to have a Manhattan Project that would create alternative fuels so we wouldn't even have to have a war for oil in the Middle East and what have you. But that makes too much sense, doesn't it?
A.A.P., could you imagine if they had a foreign government military base on Belle Isle?
Well, yeah. Maybe one of those. It's like Ecuador. Someone's going to want it. You got one in our country? We want to have one in your country. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate your call. Here is Stephen in Redford. Stephen, hi. It's Peter and Jelaine.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing tonight?
Good. Can you turn your radio off?
I had my radio off.
Oh, okay.
Or down.
My issue that I have to talk about is there's, like, I don't know if you call it racism, but all the black people, they can call me the N-word. But see, if I were to say it...
Yeah, they'd probably be mad at you. You're right. I don't know what to say about that, but thank you for calling. Let's see. Here is Jeff in Lincoln Park. Jeff, hi. It's Peter and Jelaine. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I just want to comment about the auto worker wages. You know, I just it's hard for me to feel sorry about their wage, relatively speaking, when I'm $40,000 in college debt with a bachelor's degree, and my neighbor's making the exact same money when he filled out an application, took a sixth-grade entrance test, and, you know, he's working the line. I'm not talking like skilled trades or anything. He's making the exact same money as me.
Well, again, Jeff, that's what I'm saying. This turns out to be the politics of resentment. Unions, let me say it again, unions set wage levels because if everything's left to the market, the wages go way down. I mean, you got to remember, the owners wound up during the 1930s killing 300 union workers. And all throughout, look up in history. and see what the owners have done in order to maintain a non-union situation. They've called it the National Guard that have massacred men, women, and children. I mean, there's famous things all over the world. As late into the 1930s, there was a massacre in Chicago where the Chicago police opened fire at a steelworkers' picnic and killed women and children and union workers. They know that without the union, their labor costs are going to be way, way down. And the only way that we have the capacity to raise what we get back is through organized labor. Without it, we're just facing them one by one. And you know what? They ain't going to be real generous because they never have been to the point where they're willing to kill employees in order to keep wages down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I would agree. It is envy because, like I told them, the only reason I did go to college is because Ford wasn't hiring. And that was, I mean, that's honest to God truth.
What did you get a degree in?
I'm in the healthcare, physical therapist.
Yeah, well.
So I have a bachelor's degree as well, and I know a boatload of people who make more money than me.
I never graduated college. I don't know what the hell that says. Yeah.
We'll start with you.
I'm 2 ADD. Yeah, but you know, hopefully you'll get a reward out of the work that you're doing.
And those student loans. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, why? Yeah. I mean, what the anger should be directed at is the fact that you're left with $40,000 in debt.
Yeah, a friend of mine who is in school right now says to me, you know, I have to keep going to school because the minute I'm done, I have 6 months and I got to start paying this stuff back.
Yeah. Why isn't college free?
Yeah, good question.
High school is free.
Yeah.
Yeah, middle school is free. Elementary is free. Yeah. Why isn't college? This is the wealthiest country in the world. Why do we force people like Jeff to go $40,000 in debt?
And that's a small amount compared to a lot of the people I know getting their, you know, their doctorates. And
look what this guy has got of training in, physical therapy.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about a contribution to society, taking
Absolutely.
On a profession that is going to help people.
Yeah, I mean, that's right.
Definitely. Well, so much more that we could have talked about. I knew you probably wouldn't even let me. I want to talk more about drugs.
We've spent the last three shows talking about that.
The Marines, which have been sent to Afghanistan now, Bravo Company's 1st Platoon sleep beside a grove of poppies. Troops in the 2nd Platoon playfully swat at the heavy opium bulbs while walking through the fields. Afghan laborers scraping the plant's gooey rosin smile and wave. And last week, the 24th Marine Expeditionary Unit moved into southern Helmand Province, the world's largest opium poppy growing region, and now find themselves surrounded by green fields of the illegal plants that produce 90% of the world's heroin.
Yeah, remember right before we went over it to Afghanistan, we gave the Taliban $43 million?
Absolutely.
To wipe out Bush. We didn't. Thank you. Thank you.
Bush gave our money.
Our money, $43 million, to wipe out the poppy crops.
Yeah.
And what? Well, they're back. It's so surprising.
Yeah.
And so are the Taliban.
Yeah, and now
they never went away.
The Taliban are now they're growing it and making up to $100 million from the drug use and fighting the Marines.
And they're so high while they're doing it.
And, and they say it's First Lieutenant Adam Lynch of Barnstable, Massachusetts. It's kind of weird. We're coming over here to fight the Taliban, and we see this, the poppies. We know it's bad, but at the same time, we know it's the only way locals can make money.
They're the only source of income many of these people have had their entire lives.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Thank you so much for listening and for calling. Jalene Jordan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you to Al for answering the phones and being a fabulous producer.
Absolutely, indeed. And stay tuned. Coming up, I have an interview with a dean from Yale University talking about our environment. Ooh. And then Utah Phillips, check out my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. Go to the calendar, and you'll see the benefit for Utah Phillips, singer, songwriter, and troubadour of the industrial workers of the world. We'll talk next week.
This is WRIF.com.
Looking out,
there.
The pictures. The podcast. The vlogs.
The special features you just can't get.
Anywhere else.
Super f***ing cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I salute yourself.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks. Davidson XL1200N Sportster Nicer. Courtesy of Motor City Harley Davidson. A 2-year lease on a 2008 Dodge Ram. 1500 quad cab Laramie 4x4. Courtesy of Oakland Dodge. A trip for two to Harley Davidson's 105th anniversary celebration. Labor Day weekend in Milwaukee. Courtesy of Miller Lite. And $500 worth of gas to get you there. Compliment to the rim. Keep it tuned to 101 WRIF to win $50 in free gas. Plus a key to these sweet wheels and more. June 14th at Freedom Hill in Sterling Heights. Also, listen for details on Harley Bike Nights around the Motor City, where you can win a key in person. Think you can handle the Rush Harley Fest 2008? Presented by Motor City Harley Davidson. Feel the freedom at the number one dealer in Farmington Hills. Also presented by Miller Lite. Miller Lite. Bigger, bolder, summer. Oakland Dodge and your Harling Fest 2008 station. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. We seem to be at a lot of crises about the environment recently, don't we? There's everything from the weather to food crises. So many things that environmentalists have been sounding the alarm for a generation and a half at a minimum. And yet we don't seem to learn our lessons. I don't know if this is one last lesson, but it certainly is said in an incredibly challenging and provocative manner. The book is called The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability. The author is James Gustav Speth, and I think it would almost be enough just to say that James Gustav Speth is Dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University and the author of this book. But before I go on anymore, let me bring him in from his office at Yale University. Welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, Peter. Delighted to be with you.
Well, I think also what's important is this very long incredible accomplishments throughout your life, a Rhodes Scholar. You co-founded the Natural Resources Defense Council. You chaired the President's Council on Environmental Quality under President Jimmy Carter and was president and founder of the World Resources Institute, acted as a senior advisor to President-elect Bill Clinton's transition team. That all says very, very mainstream. Yet this book, Bridge at the Edge of the World, particularly when we begin talking about capitalism, the environment, and crossing from crisis to sustainability, says that something's happened to make you look at the world in a manner that maybe was a transition.
Well, it certainly has been. I must say, I've been in the trenches of the mainstream environmental movement for four decades now. And one of the good things about being in academia is, like at Yale here, is you can sit back and think a little bit, and I've had the occasion to do that. And what I've realized is that there's a paradox here in my life, in the life of our country, in the life of our planet, really. We've had now four decades of mainstream environmentalism. The environmental movement has gotten stronger. It's gotten more sophisticated and more numerous in terms of people participating in various issues and organizations. And yet the environment has continued to go downhill despite this presence and efforts of really serious good efforts for now a long time, and it's like we're swimming upstream and we get stronger, but the current gets stronger than we get, and so we continue to drift away, and the data on environmental conditions and trends is not good. It's very disturbing. We're on the verge of unprecedented environmental losses with the climate issue leading the way here, I'm afraid, And if we continue doing what we're doing today, we will, and I don't want to exaggerate, but we will leave a ruined world for our children and grandchildren, which I now have some of, and I'm very worried about them.
Well, yes, I can imagine it. I think about the youth and what we are going to leave them. But if we're all environmentalists, and I can't imagine that less than 15% of people that you see in these polls do not identify the environment as extraordinarily important, why in the world are things getting worse? You would think, just as a matter of course, things would be getting better.
Well, they're not, unfortunately. I could give you a chapter and verse on the declining conditions. Certainly some things are better. I mean, our air in our cities is better today, although there's still very serious problems, despite, 40 years of work on the problem. The water's better, but things like climate and the loss of our open space, we're losing 6,000 acres a day of open space in the United States. We have toxic chemical soup. We're living in it. They're just on and on. The problems are very severe nationally and even worse internationally. And so what's going on? Well, I tried to diagnose that in the book. How could this paradox be understood? And I think the bottom line is that we are struggling in against a set of forces which are overwhelming us, in effect. So I looked at what those forces really were, and they are things like the enormous premium we put on sustained and high rates of economic growth, as if that is going to solve all the problems, and I want to come back to that. our extraordinary commitment to consumerism and hyperventilating lifestyles. The power of our major corporations today, they're not just the main economic actors anymore, they're the main political actors. A market where prices are not reflecting the real cost of to the environment and to society of producing those goods and services, so that the prices that we pay are artificially low. We all love low prices, but you know we're in fact building huge environmental subsidies into those prices, and we don't have environmentally honest prices. So we overconsume things that are very destructive environmentally and underconsume other things. And so that all of these issues come together. And I had to put a name on that, and I can't think of a better name than that's the capitalism that we have today. That's the system of capitalism that we know. And it's not some idealized version, but it's a capitalism that that we have, and that's what we're up against, and those forces are really too strong. And so the environmental community has been reluctant to challenge that system. It's been reluctant to tell people, well, we need different lifestyles. It's been reluctant to challenge the corporate sector. It treats political reform, which we desperately need, as a non-environmental issue. It treats dealing with our social problems as a non-environmental issue. So you have half the country in fairly desperate straits financially and insecure economically. So we need a new approach. We've got to challenge the system.
Well, now, there must be some head spinning here, because we have James Gustav Speth, Dean of the School of Forestry Environmental Studies at a prestigious elite university, Yale, and it sounds like he's criticizing capitalism, and we know that the only people that criticize capitalism are you know, either our former enemies or our enemy. I mean, because it's speak to that some. I mean, we don't criticize capitalism anymore at all.
Well, when you raise these issues, people, talk about an alternative to capitalism, and people don't think there really is one. What I say in the book, Peter, is that, you know, I'm looking, and I think we should be looking as a society for a non-socialist alternative to today's capitalism. And if we make the changes that I talk about in the book and that I alluded to a moment ago, then, you know, we'll have a different system. It'll still have a lot of private enterprise at its core, and a lot of private ownership as its main way of carrying out, you know, our lives. But private enterprise and market forces, but they'll be very different. It'll be very, very different, and it won't be today's capitalism. It'll be a system that is far more localized in terms of our lives and less consumptive of resources, more respectful of each other, more emphasis on our communities, and people less insecure economically, more, you know, respect for each other, but these are basic changes where we need to, you know, what I say in the book is, in the end, I think that we have three great problems in our country today, and they really boil down to one problem: a tremendous problem of achieving social justice, a tremendous problem of achieving environmental sustainability, mm-hmm. and an equally tremendous problem of reforming our political system so that we have, you know, we take back the country. We have real popular control in our country. And they're all really the same issue, because we're all up against, they all represent values, real human values that we're trying to inject into this system, which mainly cares about profits and growth. And we're all failing. And if we're going to succeed, we're going to have to join forces.
Now, if you want to see more of this book, you can go to the website, thebridgeattheedgeoftheworld.com. I'll have a link on my site, peterwerby.com, as well. James Gustav Speth is my guest, and he's the author of the book. I don't have the stomach for listening more than a couple of minutes of right-wing radio. And I was listening one time, and the most famous of them all said, "Look out for these environmentalists. They want to take away your SUVs. And I could just imagine them listening to James Gustav Speth and saying, see, here is an example. This guy wants to take away what we want. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think people are abandoning their SUVs.
They are, for one thing.
Pretty quickly right now. And instead of it being some planned thing to free us up from international oil dependence, it's something that is being forced on us and creating massive profits for certain individuals in certain countries, certain companies in certain countries, and so we're going about it all wrong. I think the we do need. I remember, Al Gore was criticized one time for saying something like, we need to, in Detroit, I think he said, we need to reinvent the car.
Mm-hmm.
He said that a long time ago. And if we'd actually started back then to reinvent the car and doing some of the things which we're finally getting around to, like moving to plug-in hybrids and other things, the economy of the state of Michigan would be in much better shape.
Certainly, indeed. But I guess what this really speaks to is not so much the SUV, because as you said, the sales of big trucks and SUVs coming out of Detroit are dropping quickly. But it's the whole idea of what we take for granted, and that is a consumerism that gives us all sorts of toys and pleasures and 56-inch television sets and what have you. And it always looks to some people, or at least the charge is, that the environmentalists want this reduced lifestyle, they're sort of dour, you want everyone to have less, right? Whereas the idea of expanding consumer capitalism was that we would all have more, and one day everybody in the world would have cars and 56-inch televisions and iPod phones and all that.
But what's the reality, though? The reality is that real wages haven't gone up in the United States for decades, that we have the highest poverty in 30 years, poverty rates in 30 years. So we're not applying our increased wealth, which is accruing to 1% of the population, and to dealing with our social problems. And it's enormously destructive environmentally, all this sort of random growth that we have, rather than targeted growth. And here's the real kicker. If you look at the surveys that are done routinely now of how satisfied do people feel about their lives, how happy are people in their lives, and this whole idea of personal well-being, what you see is that it's that GDP, our wealth per capita has gone up, but this idea of happiness, of satisfaction with life, has been flatlined for decades now. It is not going up. So this idea that somehow we are, going to make ourselves more fulfilled by buying more and more stuff doesn't work. And we all know that at one level. We know it. If you ask people and poll people, do you think America is too materialistic? Over 80% say yes. Do you think we're focusing too much on spending and getting? And not enough on our relationships and giving. 80+% say, yes. So I think there's a huge misdirection of life's energy out there. I know I sound like a preacher, but
well, go preach on. What's damning it all up? Here we said that when they do polls, 80-85% of the people said they believe in environmental values. The polls you just cited about happiness say people aren't. What are the impediments here?
Well, we're just barraged with a huge apparatus which is aimed at selling and marketing. It's very sophisticated. And the society keeps us we're the hardest working people among all of the rich countries. We put in more hours of work. We have both spouses now working, and it's just becoming more and more frenetic. We really don't have time to do things, and we're not making we're not making time to enjoy life anymore, and we're caught up in this machine. So there are a lot of things that we need to do to unhinge, so to speak, and to step back and take a different approach to life that is more reflective and more attuned to what our real needs are. All the happiness studies show, for example, that what makes people really happy is associations with other people, is being, you know, having warm personal relationships, and also, you know, giving rather than getting all the time. And as the expression goes, you know, materialism is toxic to happiness. And so I, anyhow, the book is, the bulk of the book are a series of chapters that deal with these issues about corporations, about consumerism, about growth, about the real sources of human happiness, and how, and our politics, and how we need to make changes in all of these areas. The environmental costs are very high, but so are the social costs.
Well, I know frequently when people suggest something, even in smaller things like at work, I say that makes perfect sense. You'll never get anywhere. In other words, that the madness of this world that seems like we're on the highway to hell on so many different planes seems obvious to so many people, but there are so many large, powerful social institutions that have a vested interest in things remaining exactly as they are. Let me just one quick example. We're seeing around the world, you know, riots about fuel or riots about food, and yet these huge agricultural agricultures, agribusiness corporations, and the oil companies are making a fortune. So they're doing just fine with things going to hell.
Well, so are the food companies. It's not just the oil companies.
Yeah.
It's the big, you know, Archer Daniels Midland,
sure,
and others in the food business. I think the, you know, you're getting at what might drive real change in our country. And I do talk about that in the book. And I think there are three things that we, you know, have to hope for and count on in a way. One is that we are seeing the, I think, the birth of the beginnings of a grassroots social movement in the country. It's not big and powerful yet, but I think it's beginning. You can see it in the young people. You can see it in a lot of community activists. You can see it in religious organizations. And if we could actually achieve a coalescing of people who are deeply concerned about the environment, concerned about social justice, concerned about the, you know, political reform and wresting back real popular sovereignty, you know, we could build that movement, and I think that's hopeful. The second thing that can happen, of course, is that we could have a sense of crisis. I hope it doesn't have to be a real crisis, but a sense, if people really perceive how serious our situation is, say environmentally, for example, and how close we are to having, you know, widespread climate destruction, I think we could, you know, you can create a sense of a virtual crisis in effect, and I think that will also make people pay attention. As I didn't often agree with economist Milton Friedman, but he said one thing that I think was right on, which was, you know, only a crisis produces real change. And so maybe a sense of crisis of imminent crisis can produce, yeah, real change. The third thing is, you know, we're seeing across our country small-scale examples of people trying to live better lives, to build better communities, to do things differently, employee ownership, co-ops, community enterprises, lots of things are going on in our country that provide, you know, sort of models, and so I think there's room for hope here, but it won't be easy. But what's actually harder in many ways is to just try to keep doing what we're doing.
Yeah, you know, one of the, of course, always hope for the future is young people, our young people, and you're a dean at Yale University, and we're sort of in the middle between the you and I, between the generation of our parents that lived through the Depression and through an era of deprivation. We came into an era of plenty, and now young people are sort of they're being attracted by all these baubles of consumption. Are they buying it?
I think young people are as in a way as diverse as the rest of us in many ways, but certainly I see a lot of students who are very interested in profound change in society, and I think that's very so something's going on. I truly believe it. Something's going on. And we have to encourage that and support it. There is a kind of perversity a little bit. I've heard some of the students and young people say to old fogies like me, you're encouraging youth activism. What about adult activism?
yeah.
Because, you can't throw, just because you guys didn't do such a good job with these issues for the last few decades, you can't just throw them all on us. And it's absolutely right.
Yeah, there certainly the key to it is an end to the social and political passivity. And people talk about this coming election, the presidential election, which I think is important. But I always say, I hope that's only about the seventh thing that I do, voting in that Tuesday in November, because that's the easiest thing. And in many ways, it throws our future to hoping that the person that gets in there will do what we want, whereas in the past, the American social movements, even the one that began this country, it was the people themselves that defined a new reality.
Let's take something that's really at the core of what I'm concerned about, and that's the climate disruption. Now, there's some far-reaching bills moving in the Congress today to address the problem of climate change. And both of the Democratic presidents and even Senator McCain have programs to address the issue. The Democrats are stronger than McCain's, but McCain's is not bad, and he's actually been a leader on the climate issue. So what's going to happen? These issues get into the Washington, death by a thousand cuts machine, and these legislations get hacked away and weakened, and the implementation can be weakened as it goes from Congress to the agencies and all. So what we'll have to have is a very powerful citizens movement around the climate issue that's pushing this process and ensuring that that Washington doesn't fail again, because we can't afford it this time. We're really on the cusp of serious climate change here. So we need this grassroots movement, and I'm proud to be associated with a group that's trying to build that grassroots movement. If any of your listeners are interested, it's called One Sky. .org, one as in the number one, and is trying to coalesce all the groups around the country that are working to build a grassroots climate movement.
Wait a minute, give us, I wasn't quite sure, the numeral one or spelled out?
Well, the number one, the numeral one.
Yeah, and then Sky?
One Sky, yeah.
One Sky dot
org.
.org, yes. One Sky. Yeah. Okay, I'll link that on my site as well, along with your book. You're probably surprised I'm going to quote Vice President Cheney, but when they mentioned to him something about consumer choices, he said, those are just gestures. And a number of us try to be good environmental citizens, but it doesn't have the overall impact that we'd like. Is it a combination of both individual choices and acts and also the larger political and social movements?
Yeah, no, you've put it exactly right. I think I look at my case. My wife and I have purchased a couple of hybrid vehicles. We purchased a solar photovoltaic unit to produce electricity in our house. We recycle a lot. We try to offset our greenhouse gas emissions on the internet, and yet we spend a lot of money. In fact, two decent salaries, despite all those things, our environmental footprint is still quite large, so you can do all these things. They are very important to do. I would encourage everyone to take up a lot of these places now, which are providing information on how to live greener, to take those things seriously. But in the end, we have some structural issues, that we need to address the bigger picture, and that requires government. We can't go through another period in our country where, you know, to use Grover Norquist's phrase, you know, we want to shrink government down to the point that it's so small we can drown it in the bathtub. That was what he said. And we need government. I mean, government is the way we effectuate our values and our concerns about our children and our families into public policies that our country desperately needs.
Well, Norquist is one of those people that wants the world to remain as it is. James Gustav Speth is going the other direction, fortunately. The book is called The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability. You can go to thebridgeattheedgeoftheworld.com. I'll have a link on my site, peterwerby.com, and also the site mentioned by our guest, onesky.org. I'll have that linked as well. James Gustav Speth, thanks so much for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Oh, what a pleasure.
This is WRIM.com.
The Rick satisfies your need for speed with racing action that rocks. Memorial Day weekend rocks as 101 WRIM and Firestone present exclusive IMS Radio Network coverage of the 92nd running of the Indianapolis 500 Sunday, May 25th, starting at noon. In 2008, 101 WRIM is your home for Indianapolis Motor Speedway Network race coverage from the green all the way to the checkered flag. The granddaddy of them all, the Indianapolis 500, live from the Brickyard. Presented by Firestone. Firestone, presenting sponsor of the Detroit Indy Grand Prix on 101 WRIM. The Riff.
The word addiction in certain companies. Yes, she tells you she's an orphan after you meet her family. world as black as night now. She pulls those shades down tight. Oh yeah, there's a smile when the pain comes.
The $40,000 Rick Rock Girl Search is really heating up. 101 WRIF and Bud Light are looking for one woman to represent the Riff for 1 year. It's come down to our 8 final contestants. And now, it's up to you to decide. Log on at WRIF.com and vote for your favorite from the Exotic 8. You can also text your vote by typing in the contestant's name to 71913. Courtesy of Wireless Toys, your cellular superstore. Only you will decide who will be the next Riff Rock Girl. Representing the Riff with VIP access to concerts and events. An on-air gig with the world-famous 101 WRIF and a $40,000 salary. Here on makeup provided by Six Salon, where it's all about you. In Royal Oak, Birmingham, and their newest location inside the MGM Grand Detroit Casino and Hotel. The 2008 Riff Rock Girl Search. Brought to you by Bud Light. Keeps it coming at 101 WRIF. Everything rocks. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
This is Peter Werby, and thank you so much for being with me. Those of you who have listened to this broadcast over the years know that I'm a union member and very pro-union, and you may have heard me talk about the industrial workers of the world. They organized a lot back here in Michigan 70, 80 years ago. They were up in our northern peninsula with the miners and the loggers and what have you. But the IWW has not gone away. It still exists. In fact, you can take a look at it at IWW.org. And one of the most wonderful things that the IWW did, besides its organizing, besides its vision of a new world, was to produce an amazing amount of storytellers and songwriters and troubadours of labor. Very exciting stuff, and a lot of it is of the past. But we are very, very fortunate to have with us Utah Phillips. And Utah Phillips is a folk singer, storyteller, historian, philosopher, even a hobo. We'll talk about all that as we welcome Utah Phillips to the Peter Werby Show. We're reaching him in Nevada City, California. Utah, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very, very much. You know, I don't sing those songs from the IWW's artifacts. I sing them unhappily because they're just as true today as they were then. I mean, take Joe Hill's Power in the Union he wrote in 1912. Well, you know, there is power in the union. You know, I was born in a time in the mid 1930s when over 60% of the wage workers in this country belonged to unions. And what's the percentage now?
Pretty low, particularly in the private sector.
One of the reasons why I've been singing those songs for so many years and telling those stories, saying, "Look what we were able to do when we were organized."
Mm-hmm.
Able to break the back of the sweatshop system in Lawrence, Massachusetts, the Lawrence Textile Strike, then I can sing Bread and Roses. You know, I can sing about, well, on and on. The titanic amount of energy, of struggle, and bloodshed has gone into ending up with an eight-hour day, ending up with mine safety laws, with child labor laws, you know, creating such pressure from below that, well, okay, look at me right now. I'm laid up. I've got serious, serious heart disease. I have a permanent catheter in the middle of my chest and a tube coming out of a bag on my shoulder with medicine and a pump that goes directly into my heart. That's what keeps it beating. That's all from Medicare, okay? So much pressure from below that we got Social Security, we got Medicare, but then we got workman's comp, and we got unemployment insurance and minimum wage, things unheard of in the rest of the industrial world. Why? Because workers were able to organize. That past is the mirror that we look into when we look at ourselves today and say, what the hell are we doing?
Well, I was going to say that we've made lots of strides forward, but in many ways, people say we're going back to the 19th century. When you said eight-hour day, a lot of people around here, if they still have their job, are saying, eight-hour day, I can't remember one of those. And
we fought and we scrabbled and we scrooged and we went to the wall and went to jail by the thousands to help us to emerge from an industrial dark age. And now we're stumbling blindly back into it. It has to stop. You know, really has to stop. And you know where that starts?
Hmm.
I know exactly where that starts. That arresting this, and that it starts in the public schools. In the public schools, we have kids coming out of high school who don't know what a scab is, don't know what a union is.
Well, you better, Utah Phillips, you better tell people what a scab is, because I don't think anybody thinks it's anything other than what's on your arm after you cut it.
Well, good, no. A scab is somebody who will cross a picket line and work at your job as a replacement. They call them replacement workers now, but a scab is a scab. It's the worst thing you can be is to betray your own working class. What is the working class? The working class, if you work for wages and you got a boss, you're in the working class. Doesn't matter if you're a college professor or a ditch digger. You're in the working class and better be proud of it.
Well, Utah Phillips, let's do this. Let's just go through a little of your biography, because in that we see reflected a lot of these things that you're talking about in general. Very specifically, you were in the United States Army beginning in 1956, and you were in Korea. Pick it up from there and tell us how that influenced your life choices.
I want to go back a little bit before that, because my mother worked for a time for the CIO, the Congress Industrial Organization. And, of course, that was what really rescued the labor movement. The CIO, starting in 1935, the year I was born, was the really the rebirth of the idea of industrial unionism, a more latter-day IWW. So my mother was a strong, strong union woman, and she had the books, you know, in the house. She never tried to force me to be or do anything, but the materials were always there. And then out of high school, with no negotiable skills at all, I rode the trains for a while, just freight. And then I joined the Army. I mean, talk about a dumb move. Some people learn things the hard way, and I'm one of them. But then you never forget it.
Okay.
So I wound up a radar tech in Massachusetts, Boston area anti-aircraft defense. And I managed, through sheer clumsiness and ineptitude, to fry an enormous amount of radar equipment just by pushing the wrong button. And, of course, the orders came down, get this guy out of here. So I was pipelined for Korea. And I was hauling around a rifle and trying to avoid infiltrators. This is after Panmunjom, after the truce. But the place was crawling with people who really didn't want you there and were willing to let you know it. But that's where I really woke up. Korea, where somebody said, tell me about with Korea, I'll say crying babies. That's it. The orphanages I visited with 100 kids, babies in it, a lot of them GI babies, blonde-headed kids. And then the GIs had gone home, and these kids were there, and the Koreans wouldn't accept them, and the U.S. government wouldn't acknowledge them. And I'd go around to the various units and raise money, to get bags of rice to send in there. One time I used to go up to the guard tower when I was toward the rear and look out over the paddies, which were emptied and drained during the day, during the winter, and they're cold. These little guys with shoeshine boxes would show up at our gate, try to make how much ever they could, off the GI shine in the boots. And then they carve out a little hole in the dike, the sides of the paddies, and crawl in there and make a little fire. I'd get up in the guard tower and spot the fires so that I could take canteen cups full of cocoa or coffee out in the morning. And one time I found one of the little boys dead and frozen. And I carried him in and told the commander, said, give him to the Catoosas. The Koreans attached to the U.S. Army, the soldiers. So I did. And they took him, but I could see by the way they looked at me how much they hated me.
Hmm.
They really hated me. And then finally, where I finally broke down was up on the Imjin River, Kumari, around there. I wanted to swim in the Imjin River. I wanted to wash all of that off, what I had seen and what I've been doing. I wanted to wash it away. And Yun Suk Han, the young Korean who spoke some English, said, you can't swim in the Imjin. I said, why not? He said, because because when young people get married here, they move in with the grandparents. But there's nothing growing. Everything's been destroyed. And so when the first baby comes, somebody has to leave. And it's generally the old man, the grandfather. And he will sit on the bank of the Yimjin with a gourd of water and wait to die. And his body will roll down into the water. And he said, you can't swim in the Yimjin because those are our elders being carried away to the sea. And that was it for me. That's when I knew that I was the wrong person in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that it all had to change. It all had to change. I remember particularly the instant that that all came together for me. Can I tell you another story?
Let me do this first. Let me tell people that we're talking with Utah Phillips, who is an IWW, Industrial Workers of the World folk singer and labor organizer. And there'll be a benefit because Utah, after these years of traveling, of folk singing, what have you, is in ill health. And although he has medical coverage, we what's called in the IWW movement, fellow workers are going to be assembling in a benefit concert for Utah Phillips, and it's going to be this Wednesday, May 14th. It's going to be at the ARC in Ann Arbor, ARK. You can just look up the ARC box office, and it's going to be led by Garnett Rogers, also Matt Watroba, Mick Lane, Chris Buhalis, Len Wallace, and others as well. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com, and go to my calendar. It's all there. Also, utahphillips.org and iww.org. Utah Phillips, would we like another story? Of course. Go ahead.
Well, I'll continue that one because it was another event that really changed everything for me. I wound up kind of running away from the Army in Korea. I'd bug out. I'd just here for, I don't know, 3-4 days to a week. And there was an organization of Koreans trying to get the GIs to understand more about Korean culture than what they were getting from the village around the military camps. And they were the ones who kind of hid me when I was down over in Seoul City. One night, driving rain, cold rain, they took me to a concert at the AWOL Women's University, which still had shell holes in the ceiling. We sat in the auditorium, the little thin rain coming through the holes in the ceiling, and it was a concert. And I didn't speak much Korean, so I didn't know what I was there for. There's these Klieg lights illuminating the stage in a ghostly sort of way. And onto the stage came Marian Anderson.
Huh. The
Marian Anderson, the great black soprano for the Metropolitan, first opera singer, black woman to sing at the Metropolitan Opera. She was doing a tour of the military in the Orient, and there she was. And my mind snapped back to when I was a boy in Salt Lake, and my father, my stepfather Sid Cohen, ran the movie theaters there, the big movie theaters. And one year he invited Marian Anderson to come and sing there at the Capitol Theater. That would have been 1948 or 49. And we went down to the train station to pick her up. Well, she got off the train, an elegant, marvelous woman, and we took her to the best hotel in town, the Hotel Utah. And they wouldn't let her stay there because she was black.
Wow.
And now here she was, here was I in Korea with the mud and the rain and the chronic racism around me among the fellow soldiers. It was Marian Anderson on the stage singing, "Oh Freedom," and nobody knows the trouble I've seen. And then I really knew it was all over, that it was all wrong. Everything was wrong, and it all had to change, and that change had to begin with me.
And how did you separate from the Army? What, did you wind up with an honorable discharge, dishonorable?
Oh, yeah, well, I played the game, and then I wound up in Fort Riley when I got back on the troop ship Mitchell, where I made a good bit of money shooting craps. I'm really no anybody who's going to shoot craps with me is either suicidal or insane. I'm just good. So I want to have money to float myself when I got out because I knew I wasn't good for anything. I wasn't going to go get a job and just pretend things were normal. They weren't normal. I was half crazy. So and wound up in Fort Riley, Kansas for a while, and that's where they discharged me. And then I went back, made my way back to Seattle, and then I got on the trains again. And
then when we describe you as a hobo, that's when you were riding the rails, right?
Yeah, a hobo is a, not a tramping. A hobo works and wanders, a tramp dreams and wanders, and a bum drinks and wanders. So, you know, I wasn't out there to find a work job. I had a Missouri bankroll in my bindle, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know if I could live in the country anymore. No, I was tramping. You know, I wasn't looking for work. I was wandering.
And you were what, in your late 20s? You were talking about late 20s.
Yeah. That's about right. Let me see. Yeah, at 25, around there.
Okay, go ahead.
But I saw a whole lot of the country, and I was right close to the ground all the time. And it was there that I realized that I had a great, passionate, and enormously curious love of the country. I wanted to know every corner of it. But I was down at the bottom, you know, just with people, scuffling. And that's what probably rescued me. When I was finally able to make the distinction that Mark Twain made, loyalty to the country always, loyalty to the government when it deserves it.
I like that.
I have yet to find that instance, but it may show up.
Well, you wound up with an organization called the Catholic Worker Movement, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was Ammon Hennessy, one of Dorothy Day's great friends, and loved Dorothy, you know, with a great animal passion, and she loved Ammon Hennessy with a great spiritual passion. And they used to say in the Catholic Workers, the horniest of men meets the holiest of women. Well, never the twins should meet. So he came west to start the Joe Hill House of Hospitality for transients and migrants. And I had got a job, you know, in a warehouse, and then one with the state. But I spent a lot of time, about 8 years, working with Ammon Hennessy at the Joe Hill House. And he was Ammon Hennessy was a anarchist, pacifist, Catholic, vegetarian, one-man revolution in America is what he called himself.
Now, that's what I'd like to aspire to. By the way, we should tell people that don't know that Joe Hill was an organizer for the Industrial Workers of the World, was framed up on a murder charge.
In Utah,
and executed by firing squad.
Yeah, firing squad, November 19th, 1915.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they tied him to the kitchen chair. And the guns for the firing squad, they weren't handheld. They were mounted in the paint shed on boxes with the muzzle sticking out ports in the wall, and they had already been beaded for that post, you know, right behind the kitchen chair. So all the executioners had to do was to bend over and pull the triggers.
Wow. Yeah, Joe Hill's body was cremated, and his ashes were distributed to the IWW union locals throughout the country.
Well, all over the world.
All over the world.
And they were distributed in a little package, a little envelope with his picture on one side and his last will on the other. And do you know that last will?
You tell us.
My will is easy to decide, for there is nothing to divide. My kin don't need to fuss and moan. Moss does not cling to a rolling stone. My body, if I could choose, I would to ashes it reduce, and let some merry breezes blow them to where some flowers grow. Perhaps a fading flower then might come to life and bloom again. This is my last and final will. Good luck to all of you. Joe Hill.
Wow. And his famous line is what? Don't.
Well, he wrote a letter to Big Bill Haywood, and he said in that letter, "They've got me, Bill. Don't mourn for me. Organize."
Yeah. Tell us about how you, and you know, this, of course, talking with you, Utah Phillips, is time goes by so rapidly, and we are, it is going by quickly here as well. So it's the late 50s or so, the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, what's called also the Wobblies, they're diminished in size from the great heyday that they were 65, 70 years before that. How did you tie up with, hook up with the IWW, and how did you find it at that particular time?
As a young boy, it found me serendipitously. As a boy, you know, in high school, I'd go out to a national park like Yellowstone to get summer work, and I'd work in the kitchen as a pearl diver, what we call now a hydroceramic technician.
Dishwasher, yeah, okay.
Yeah, dishwasher. And then there was the road crew guys, mainly old drunks, alcoholics, were just good enough to shovel gravel. We're up in these clapboard shanties in the trees where the tourists couldn't see you. At night, they'd have a fire, and they'd sing old songs. That's why I first started learning how to sing these old songs. One of those guys had the rigging for a delegate from the IWW, and he didn't even know if the union still existed.
Hmm.
And he signed me up after all these macho stories. You know, I joined for all the wrong reasons. And then when I got back from Korea, I read as much as I could. I thought about it. I called Carl Keller, the General Secretary Treasurer of the Wobblies in Chicago, and we corresponded. And then I rejoined the union. I've been really a member of the IWW for over half a century. And it's still my proudest association. The philosophy of industrial unionism, an injury to one is an injury to all.
Tell us some about your singing and storytelling career. Did you ever keep track of how many concerts you've done?
Oh, good heavens, no. You know, I was backed into this trade. I didn't choose it.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful, fine, honorable, great trade, and it gave me that opportunity to explore the country and all of North America, you know, town for town. I beat the streets and talked to people and visit organizations. It's been a carnival. I'm just so frustrated that I can't be out there anymore. But, see, I ran for the U.S. Senate in 1968 on the Peace and Freedom ticket. We were on the ballot in 27 states. I had to take a leave of absence from the state job I had. And we ran a full campaign. But when it was over, my job had vanished. I couldn't get work anywhere in Utah. Somebody had always called ahead, a blacklist. So I was, you know, was still working at the second incarnation of the Joe Hill House. And one night I realized I'd run out of moves. The cops were on the way. Had an old VW bus. It was driving cold rain in November. And I got in that bus with $75 and a couple of other misfits. And we headed east with toward an uncertain future and no prospects. When I got east, I had to be told I was singing folk music. I didn't know what it was. And fortunately, I wound up at Cafe Lena in Saratoga Springs, New York, ground zero for folk music in the East. And it took me a couple of years to figure out I was now a folk singer and not an unemployed organizer. And you know, I had the songs with me. I had the songs I'd made up. I'd had the songs that I'd always sung on the picket lines, you know, since my mother used to take us out there, you know, on the line. And I had a knack for telling stories. It's all one big long story. Everybody's life is one story. All you can really hope is that in the end it will have been well told. And, you know, that's been my goal, to be well told. I love telling stories. Sometimes the stories have tunes. We call them songs and we sing them.
Well, I want to say that that I understand how much terribly frustrating it must be because of your health and not to be able to tour and to talk to people directly. I'm pleased to be able to give you this opportunity here.
Oh,
but
boy, yeah.
But people should know that so much of Utah Phillips' work is available on CD, both his storytelling and his songwriting. You can go to utahphillips.org. That's with two L's, the Phillips. Utahphillips.org. I'll have a link on my site, peterwerby.com. There's a benefit coming up and right at the end of this conversation, which is coming right up in about 2 minutes. I'll give you all of that as well.
I should interrupt and remind people that this is not for medical expenses. Like I say, I'm on Medicare. But when I finally had to stop, the only thing I ever learned how to do was to sing songs, tell stories, and leave town the next day. Our income went from a, you know, a reasonably good income to zero. And that's what people are helping us do, to get over this hard time. Excuse me, I'm losing my breath. To, you know, replace that lost income so that we can keep the heat on.
Yeah, and in the tradition of the industrial workers of the world, that's called mutual aid. That's a concept worth looking at. Listen, we only have 1 minute, and I don't know if this is even something you could answer quickly. If someone had to say, Utah Phillips, what is the proudest moment in your entire life so far, would you have a single answer?
The proudest moment in my whole life is marrying the woman who's taken over my life and is taking care of me now, Joanna Robinson. It's like living with an angel. She is the warmest, deepest heart I've ever encountered anywhere, and is indescribably beautiful. It's such a privilege to be in my situation now and have that person so much a part of my life.
I can't begin to tell you how sweet that is and how that so perfectly ends our conversation. We've been speaking with Utah Phillips, and again, I would urge you to go to his website, utahphillips.org. The CDs are both storytelling and folk songs and labor organizing music. Also, if you're interested in the industrial workers of the world, they have a current manifestation. They're organizing people in lots of different venues, no longer the loggers and the miners, but more Starbucks baristas and truck drivers out in on the West Coast. Go to IWW.org. Now, let me remind you one more time. Wednesday, May 14th, this coming Wednesday, there's going to be a benefit concert for Utah Phillips. Garnett Rogers, Matt Wotroba, Mick Lane, Chris Buhalis, Len Wallace. It's going to be a great show. I'm going to be there. Tickets, $20. All of it goes to help a man who's given all throughout his life and has got a lot more to give. Utah Phillips, it's been a pleasure having you on the Peter Werbe Show.
Well, thanks for calling me up. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Friday, May 16th, the finals of the 2008 Riff Rock Girl Search, featuring the return of Filter. With special guest, Red.
Vote for your favorite now at WRAF.com.
Then, see the final four contestants at the Royal Oak Music Theater. As the next Riff Rock Girl is chosen. Doors open at 7 p.m. All ages welcome. Free tickets still available. Get them at the Royal Oak Music Theater box office. Old Tickets.com outlets. Online at Tickets.com. AEGLive.com. Or charge at 800-919-6272. Transportation provided by Love Dodge Limousines. Call 800-LIMO for you. Or click on LABDAS.com. Your makeup provided by Six Salon, where it's all about you. In Royal Oak, Birmingham. In their newest location inside the MGM Grand Detroit Casino and Hotel. WRIS 2008 Riff Rock Girl Finals. Featuring Filter with special guest Red. Live in concert. Friday, May 16th. Brought to you by Bud Light. Bud Light keeps it coming. Wireless Toys. Your cellular superstore. At 101. WRIS. Everything that rocks.